stacked one on top of
it. Good morning. Welcome to the Chelan County Board of Commissioners. It is September 17th, 2018. Welcome to everyone. Today's kind of a special day and an interesting day. It's an opportunity to meet with the Mayor of Wenatchee and commission members and or council members as well as staff. I think in a little bit of discussion, I've been a commissioner for 12 years, and we haven't had this opportunity. And talking with Allison a little bit, it may be as far back as 2005. And the only comment I have there is that's way too long because we serve the same residents and the same customers. And it's an opportunity to grow the chance to look at those constituents through the same lens. And so it's a pretty exciting day. It's a historic day. Really looking forward to today's exchange. With that being said, all five commissioners from Chelan County PD are here today. At the head table representing Steve Wright, our general manager, is our HR director, Larna Klemanski. And regarding cell phones, please put those in some kind of a holding position so they don't disrupt the meeting. And I generally have a bad joke that I say about it, so I will spare the audience today from that bad joke. And then, again, Frank, welcome to you and the city council and staff members. And we'll have an opportunity for you to introduce them when we get to that piece of our agenda. So with that being said, we open our meetings with the Pledge of Allegiance and a safety minute led today by Adam Gormley.
It's hot. Okay. Yeah. All right. Please join me. I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all. This is my first safety minute. So, who runs the computer normally? Is that supposed to be me?
Yep. Okay. I got you right here.
Oh.
You have dueling mice.
I will just wait patiently. All right. So you can go ahead and go ahead. I just wanted to introduce this. This week we've got Child Passenger Safety Week. And this is a near and dear to my heart one because I actually have an almost two-year-old at home now. And this was a really good time for me to be reviewing this information. And there were some figures here I kind of already knew, but there was some things I might have forgotten or some timings I might need to remember again soon due to my kid growing up, basically. There's some studies out there, and some compete. Some say as many as 59% of car seats are installed incorrectly, and these are due to a number of factors. The ones that are more obvious are, oh, you didn't buckle them down right, you didn't get it tight enough, you didn't, put the little harness in the right spot on their armpits, those types of things. But the ones that were a little less obvious were, when do you upgrade them to a bigger seat? When do you turn them around? When do you go to a booster? When do you restrain them with the back harness? So, all that kinds of information. It was just sort of a reminder to look at this. As your kids are getting older, you might have grandkids. You might have nieces, nephews. You might just have friends that you have their kids in your cars from time to time. And that, I think those are the opportunities where you maybe aren't paying enough attention when it's sort of an on and off experience. So anyway, for the next slide, and there's only two slides here. I'm going to keep this pretty brief. But there's some information online where you can go to safecar.gov/the right seat, and that will talk about all kinds of information. I got way too involved in this and looked at all the statistics, and I'm like, oh, wow. I want to be better than that 59% of the statistic. I want to make sure that I'm not part of that. Some other resources you can do other than online. also, look at the laws. I know because I have a nephew that lived in Idaho for a while. Their seat laws are different than Washington seat laws. And the reason for that is that there's a national minimum requirement, and Washington's requirement is higher than that. But Idaho's is not. So you might get a ticket in Washington for a kid restrained one way where you wouldn't in Idaho, is kind of the lesson learned there. So be aware of your traveling between states, because those laws may change. Also, car recalls, car seat recalls. I don't know if you get what they say always is register your equipment, and then you'll get those notifications automatically. If you're not aware of how to do that, go online and look for your model and figure out that information on your own. And the other one is that you can go and talk to fire departments, police station here in town. My wife did this when we had our kid before we took her home. You can go and they will check your installation, and they will give you a tutorial and walk you through the process. So you can use this last year to kind of, you know, get a double check on what you've done. So I invite you to go look at this information on your own if you have those times in your life where this might be important to you. And I guess I'll stop at that.
Questions, comments? Ann?
I have something to share that I think will be helpful to some people. I have a grandson who's 8 years old, and he's severely autistic, very physical. He sits in his car seat. He has a standard car seat. He sits in his car seat, one seat behind, and my daughter drives here, and they live in San Francisco. And the other day, my daughter was driving, and he undid his car seat, jumped forward, and hit her in the face. She was able to stop, and then the other boy, the 11-year-old, jumped and grabbed the 9-year-old. So what she's learned is you can get a locking latch for that car seat. So she has done that, a lock, that because he's very clever. He can figure out how to get any out of anything. He's like a monkey. So he has an extra brace here, restraining part here, and then locking locks that these kids can't undo. And that could save somebody's life.
Very good.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I would like to comment that, well, we don't look like that we're probably new parents. Collectively, we have a lot of grandkids. And we just house sat with our grandkids over the last this past weekend. And I never thought of it in these terms until just now, but our youngest granddaughter just went through graduation. She no longer requires a car seat, which is a big plus for grandparents who are really challenged at figuring out some of those seats.
And just one more thing, I want to emphasize this more, is that I don't think people generally, I would like to think the bucket seats get installed correctly, but where people really probably have the most trouble is figuring out when their kid needs to be in the next stage. Yeah. And people turn their seats around too early, or they turn around too late, or they don't upsize early enough. I think those are probably where those 59% are coming in most often. So it's really that you need to keep on it as they grow up too. So
peer pressure.
Yes,
that's right.
Early.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Adam.
Yeah. Thanks, Adam.
One of the things I've neglected to say is that if anyone would like to address the commission, and we encourage you to do so, please state your name, address, and we will give you a reasonable length of time, and please use the microphone because our meetings are recorded so that our customers may be able to hear what it is we're saying and what we're sensing. So thank you very much. Commission, let's take a look at the approval of the agenda. Any changes? Hearing none, we'll accept the agenda as presented. Lorna, cycle of personal ownership, winner recognition.
Thank you. I would like to invite our park staff members up who were on duty at the BB Bridge Park during the fires on the hillside recently. And they were there when campers were threatened, and they demonstrated their accountability and represented the PUD very well during that time. So it looks like we have them all here, and it's Jessica Stewart, Kevin Scott, Benito Bavar, Chris Glasspool, and Kyle Endelin. And as always, you're welcome to say something if you'd like, but you are not required to say anything.
We would. Thank you very much. Please. Yeah. Thank you.
And don't forget to speak into the microphone.
I would like to thank the parks crew. Without them, they were up there late into the night on a Friday night, mm-hmm. and they were working with the sheriff's office and the fire personnel to make sure that the campers up there were safe. If any of them had any issues, they relocated some across the river to Chelan Falls Park, and they there was no question they were going to stay late and help everyone. So I would like to thank the crew very much. Thank you.
Yeah. Thank you. Oh, wow.
Although we've read about what you've done and why you were nominated, would you mind just for the record put it on the microphone and kind of repeat what happened, the events that occurred?
So about a month and a half ago, we were working nights, our usual 2 to 10:30 shift, and a fire started on the hillside next to where our park is. And it began spreading as the hours passed. And I think the closest it got was probably 500 yards up the hill. But luckily, we had a good fire team up there working on it, so we didn't have to worry that much, and we just had to take care of our business.
That's still pretty scary.
Yeah. A little bit, but I had confidence in them. I know they know what they're doing.
Very good.
Well, that's great. Well, thanks for the cool head, and you know, that means a lot to our customers and people in the park, and I appreciate all your efforts.
Thank you.
This is just another good chapter in a good book. You know, the parks are so appreciated, and the care and feeding of the parks as well as the people that frequent them is noted and appreciated. And I think the quickest way out of Dodge, if you're a commissioner, would be to come out against the parks. I think you'd be a one-term candidate, I'm sure. So, again, that's only sustained because good people are there doing good things every day in terms of maintenance and operations, and then events that are different, difficult, sometimes challenging. I've never seen our crews not rise to that occasion. So you guys need to know that you are deeply appreciated, you know, well, not only throughout the Northwest, but we have people from Texas calling ahead of time to find out if there's room to come back to our great parks, and that's a tribute to all of you. So thank you very much.
Thank you.
I'm sure you've been told in the past that the role you play as part of the face of the PUD, that what you do is in essence an ambassadorial role with our public, and we really, really appreciate how you conducted yourselves, and I know that the patrons of the park did. It's incredibly valuable. We are perceived how you are perceived, and so we thank you.
I have to share a quick story. Commissioner Bolts hit on it, but true story. I was camping in Pendleton at a campground and got to chatting with the people next to us, who was a retired Navy guy who had just come from Confluence and was bragging it up and on his way home, but already planning for a return trip the next summer. So nothing but flowing comments about how wonderfully maintained the park is, how nice the staff is. So you guys just do a great job, and what Commissioner Smith said is true. You are the ambassadors for where people coming from all across the United States camping at our parks get a chance to experience them through you and through contact with you guys. So, and gals, good job.
Thank you.
Yeah.
I have to add to that. I get more comments from customers about our parks than any other issue. And of course, they're all positive. They love the parks. They love the fact that the parks are open and available and they can go there for free. And especially the way they're maintained and the bathrooms are clean. So that's what I hear about more than any other issue. So thank you.
Yeah. Good work.
Yep.
Thank you very much. So on with the agenda, and I'd like to kind of open with a few comments, and then those will be followed up by Dan Frazier. Just had cataract surgery, so we're trying to find the focal length there. So we'll do our best. Formal agreements are oftentimes a result of quality relationships. And part of our goal for today is to be seeking common ground through relationship building, moving toward a sense of community, building trust, and adding to the quality of life of the residents of Chelan County, and in this particular case, the city of Wenatchee. The common concern that we've kind of selected to speak about is concerns that have been ongoing for a length of time regarding Columbia, parking along the Columbia River within the city of Wenatchee. And hopefully we can move toward a solution that reflects a shared philosophy. And going back historically, signed January 15th, 2010, was a memo of understanding through the waterfront sub-area planning process in 2003 and Wenatchee visioning process in 2002, it was determined that the community had a priority of access to the Columbia River. And under the guiding principles, item two states that parking and support facilities will be provided for all new uses in the park, and the city will work to maximize the parking for the development outside the park to minimize impact on available parking within the parks. Chelan County PUD has been concerned regarding parking and has taken the opportunity to provide input each time to do so. We also clearly understand that input is not the same as decision, and that the decision regarding parking is exclusively the city's. An express concern has been a portion of the park system centered, let's say, around the Pybus market area. However, it's our understanding that the city has secured funding for a parking garage, and I'd like to understand a little bit more about that if we could, please, plus an additional 17 spaces under the pedestrian overpass. And I think how we're viewing that is very clearly as a good faith effort to honor our previous understandings and express an appreciation for that. There are two primary concerns that remain, and they're differentiated significantly, but they're also differentiated from some parking in the other areas, and Dan Frazier will address that. But with the one concern is with the area commonly referred to as the Riverside 9 area. You know, I don't know of another term that just kind of glops it altogether, but if you take from the old waterworks building down through to Goodfellows, there's a whole segment through there that continues development. Part of it that concerns the PUD is that as a part of the, as we see it, as part of the incentive for development includes a reduction to the required off-street parking. And we really have, the PUD really has no available method to address this concern in any concrete way. We can give input, and we're not asking to take over your authority. We're just looking for how could we improve the opportunity to be actively involved and express our concerns, perhaps in a different format than a formal letter, or, you know, what would work better for us, what would work better for you in terms of looking at that. And again, I want to go back and emphasize that we're looking for something that's mutual. We have no authority to dictate in this situation, nor do we want to. We just have a concern that, you know, as an example, people around the Pybus area will be there. They'll do their business. They'll leave. Somebody else fills the parking spot. Sun goes down. Meal's eaten. They go home. Riverside 9 or other residential areas, people come home from work. Parking spaces are taken. They park in the park. 8 o'clock, they realize, oh, shoot, I've got my car in the park. It'll be there tomorrow morning. You know, and so it's an encroachment that is differentiated by use, And Dan will address that a little bit more fully. So we're looking for the opportunity to speak to that concern. There's a lot of new wood. As you drive down through, there's just a lot of plywood showing up. And then we also know that there's potential development further on toward the Goodfellow area. So the problem is not going to necessarily go away. We don't want it to go away. We want to see the riverfront developed. We want to see the city have the benefit of that. We want people to enjoy the parks. And so we're just looking for a way to mutually find a solution that is satisfactory to both. So with that being said, I'd like Dan Fraser to flesh out the rest of the PUD response. And I could create enemies by saying, I know you're familiar with Dan, but I don't want to say that.
Thank you, Commissioner Bowles. Commission members, Dan Fraser, Director of Shared Services. And Commissioner Bowles covered a lot of the ground that we wanted to cover today in terms of the relationship, the history of what has been occurring on the waterfront over the period of time. And I actually took this little graphic clip right out of the Wenatchee Subarea Plan. This is something that's been going on for a long time. As Commissioner Bowles referenced, 2002, 2003, the idea was we want this to renew this waterfront, and the PUD endorsed that renewal of the waterfront. Spent quite a bit of time between the PUD and the city talking about how do our parks interface with that development. It's a very important part of this. We have a lot of public parks. They call it Riverfront Park, but it just does the whole thing. It really goes all the way along the riverfront, and we knew as development was going to occur, there's going to be points of interest where access would need to be considered and how you integrate public access and private development was really a challenge, but I think it was well thought through. There was codes introduced in the city code that provided some protection to the parks as far as setbacks. There was also this memorandum of understanding. So to just give a little bit of history there, so the subarea plan really encouraged that redevelopment, and I think in terms of we knew things were going to change. It's just how do we address the impacts as they go along? This redevelopment was focused on residential, retail, commercial, recreational uses, all the things that we love about the park we could kind of bring into that next layer of development, whether it's residential, people living close to the park, that's a great thing, retail, those kind of things. It did reference parking as a challenge. Right in the study, it said it will be a challenge, and they wanted to maximize on-street parking as much as possible. So if you see Worthen Street was redeveloped back in about 2013, 14. That now has all on-street parking along there to relieve some of the on-site parking push. And one of the things that Commissioner Bowles referenced was Pybus Market. And that's an area, as you go down there on a market day and they take up some of the on-site parking with the farmer's market itself, it pushes that traffic out in, or those parking concerns out into the street. And so it's an area that we have had complaints about boat parking being taken up by people going to Pybus Market. And I think over time we've addressed some of those concerns through signage, but we just don't want to create any worse of a situation. So we want to make sure that as development occurs that it's adequately parked, as we say, so that they have the opportunity to go and utilize those businesses or live down the waterfront but not impact the park so much. What this memorandum of understanding that Commissioner Bowles referenced, it was really, we knew this was going to continue to be an issue. Through the Town Toyota Center development process, there's no way that a facility like Town Toyota Center can provide all the parking it needs on site, but it's an event-driven parking. It may be something on Friday night, it may be something on Saturday night, and then nothing for a week or more. And so they entered shared parking agreements with various adjoining and even some remote locations and bus people in. And so that's a creative way to deal with the lack of parking around a facility. One of the areas that we had a shared parking arrangement is with Walla Point Park. So really the concerns, our patrons are usually in the park earlier in the day, and the event center is generally later in the day, kind of complementary use. Let's try to share that parking. What happens is, so as part of that process, we said, okay, let's get this memorandum of understanding in place. We had a couple more developments that were kind of pushing on those park setbacks, but let's get that in place. So this MOU was really a guiding principles document. When we start talking about a specific development, how are we going to characterize the impacts on the park, and what is the city going to do to try to mitigate those, and what's the PUD going to do to accept some of those things that are changed? I mean, things are changing. We need to see how those changes affect us and accept the ones that we think are beneficial to the community. So the quote that I pulled out of there, the maximize the parking for development outside the park to minimize the impact on available public parking within the park. And that was a really key guiding principle of the document. Unfortunately, in practice, that can be very difficult. One of the provisions, the reductions that Commissioner Bowles referenced, is a reduction for transit in the area of the development. And there's two thresholds that have to be passed. It has to be within 700 feet. And they have to provide a way of meaningfully reducing the reliance on vehicles. It's called a commute trip reduction. So that's easier for something like Pybus Market, where or an employment base where people or businesses can incentivize their employees to take the bus, or they can cater to a clientele that tends to be on a bike or a pedestrian in nature. But at residential, that's very difficult because commute trip reduction strategies don't necessarily negate the need to own a car. And if it's where you live, that's where your car is going to be parked. You may not drive it to work every day. You may not drive it to the market because you can walk or take your bike, but you still own the car and you still have it. So as those types of reductions have been applied to residential uses, we've seen an increase in the overnight parking or the far after hours parking in our parks, especially in the area of Riverside 9. The Linden Tree parking lot is the one that sees the most frequently. I wasn't going to go through all of the developments that we've seen over the course of the last 4 or 5 years, but the ones that make have shown the biggest impact, or some yet to be seen, they're in development. The Hilton Garden Suites is one. There's a reduction for parking. The parking that they've identified, the public parking that was identified, is across the railroad tracks, and we don't see that as a really viable overnight parking strategy for someone staying in a hotel to park across the railroad tracks. The Riverside 9 itself was the first time the city used the alternative parking process, and it did have some nice safety valves to it. So this is one that was very creative. It allowed a reduction based on what the projected need was, and then there was check-in periods. I said, okay, if we get to a point and we know there's a pressure on the park's parking, will require the developer to develop more parking, and they did. They added about 60 spots during construction because they could see it was a problem. And then there's another safety valve which is being acted upon right now, which is a parking study that's occurring when the project hit 95% built out or occupied. And so that's underway right now. But as we go down there and see that as retail uses increase, we're starting to see that during the day, more people are parking out in the dirt, to the side of the Riverside Drive itself. And so that creates people don't want to be outdoors when there's dust flying everywhere. So to have improved paved parking, it's really important to be able to provide during the peaks that you have adequate parking. And people do, kind of the old farmer term, group your trips. If I'm going to go to Glaze, I may park in the parking lot at the park and go for a walk and then go to Glaze and have a donut and go back. That's great. That's fine. That's not what we're talking about. We're talking more about the resident that gets to home from work and there's no place to park, so they park in the park. They forget that they need to move their car, and then we have a situation where we've tagged a car to be towed or just to be ticketed. So we don't like that situation. I think we all want to be in a situation where there's adequate parking that doesn't impact the park. So that's really what we're looking for going forward, is a solution that works for both us and for the city. We want this development to continue, but we want to make sure that we're doing it in a way that doesn't impact any of the facilities greater than it needs to be. So with that.
Commissioners, comments, questions? Dan, thank you.
With that, I'd like to welcome the city of Wenatchee.
Good morning, commissioners. Thank you for giving the city of Wenatchee a few moments to talk about parking along our waterfront. I'm Mayor Frank Kuntz. With me is Steve King, Economic Development Director, Allison Williams, Executive Services Director, Rob Jammerman, raise your hand. He's our new Public Works Director from the city of Kirkland. And then Lyle Marquardt, our city council member. And I don't think I see any other city council members here this morning. So again, thank you for giving us an opportunity to spend some time with you today to talk about parking. Obviously, our city's in a pattern of growth right now. We have been working really hard with a number of developers to deal with our housing issues that we have. Still have a big need for housing, and seems to the properties that are want to be developed for multifamily happen to be in this waterfront mixed-use zone. And so you start to see Riverside 9, the one next to it, which is the same developer. That same developer is looking at a piece of property in downtown Wenatchee to build 170 apartments, five stories over two levels of parking. So we're really starting to see some intense development within our city core, some of it really close to the waterfront, some of it in our sort of our downtown core. And so from the city's perspective, we're really working hard at trying to say right fit parking. You know, you look at things like, and I say this all the time, you look at what I call the Wenatchee Mall, which is where JCPenney's is, and you look at the backside of JCPenney's and there's 5 acres of asphalt. No one ever parks there. That's not a good use of asphalt and a good use of parking, and it's really bad in our environment and not good for the community, quite frankly, because that could be a better use. Yet we have some spots near the waterfront where from time to time you have very intense parking. Near the Pybus Public Market is one, and we did a parking analysis that really does show on Saturday mornings, I think we had the red zone, right, which is a real parking issue in and around Pybus Market, clearly Saturday mornings. And now we have a hotel going in right next door, which used to be our garbage dump, which has had some overflow parking. And so we understand that that will, again, intensify mostly on weekends, we think, but there could be some other times where that becomes an issue as well. We have stuff in and around Riverside 9, mm-hmm. in and around the Town Toyota Center from time to time. You may recall last year the hockey team went a little longer than we thought they might go. And then since the carnival is no longer allowed to be in the PUD park, it is now in the parking lot of the Town Toyota Center. And so there was a hockey game, a softball tournament, and there was the carnival in the parking lot, all on the same Friday and Saturday night. And so there was, you know, two nights where parking was a real issue. And from the government's perspective, at least my perspective, do you spend $3 or $4 million on parking for two nights once every 4 years? Probably not the best use. We actually figured it out pretty well between parking the Stamil parking lot and running a shuttle. It seemed to work okay. So we're constantly trying to right size. You know, parking, as Steve King will tell you, can be an emotional issue from time to time. I don't think as a community we're quite ready to not park right in front of the place we want to go. I parked in front of KPQ this morning and walked down. Sorry, I was a little bit late. Totally fine, a block and a half. All of the 30-minute stalls right in front of your office were completely empty, right? But they're there for a reason. Again, just when I was walking in, I thought about that. I go, why is there 30-minute parking right in front? That's where people would come and pay their and it's all, no one's there. And I'm parking at KPQ because all the long-term parking's got Allison's car and Steve's car. Right? Lyle's car was there, right? So, again, this is sort of interesting sort of discussion.
It is.
These two know way more about it than I do, so I'm going to actually turn it over to them and they'll sit back in the audience. I do want to echo your comments, though. We ought to spend way more time talking about issues that are important. I do get the chance to meet with Steve Wright. We try to have coffee once a quarter. We sort of missed a little bit of that lately. I think he's been busy, and for some reason we haven't had. I quite frankly think that the Steve Wrights of the world and myself and the Peter Rutherfords and the Wes Mathesons, we ought to be meeting monthly and just having coffee and talking, because I think we can accomplish a lot with just looking eye to eye. So we look forward to it. I'm going to turn it over to those two, and I'm going to go sit over there, and I'll learn with you guys about what's going on with parking.
Frank, before you disappear, I know that there's some rumblings in the community about everything being torn up this summer and all the constructions. I would just like to say congratulations.
Thank you.
Yeah, it's necessary and it's vital. And once it's done, people will appreciate the efforts. Everybody likes new asphalt. So whatever you guys are doing, keep doing it.
I've had a lot of people say, where will that money come from? And I said, Old Station got a lot of it, right? And I'll give Wes Matheson a lot more credit than me about he recognized what it means to have a strong city, you know, the major economic hub of a region being strong financially. And with the revenue we're getting from Old Station, all of a sudden we're able to repave city streets and we're, you know, able to put money into our park system, and not quite to the level you do, but at least trying to. So, yeah, I think it's been a good process, and our crews are doing a really great job. I mean, as you guys were talking to your parks crew, I tell our folks all the time, city customers interact with those people way more than they interact with me or you or our city council members. I mean, they're the front face of what it is that you do. They're the front face of what we do.
Yeah.
And so they're the ones that get the kudos for all the good work out there. So our crews are just like yours out doing great work. And,
yeah.
Should be, you know, commended for their efforts.
Yes. So, but it doesn't happen without leadership, and we appreciate you guys.
Thank you, Dennis.
Thank you.
I'll turn it over to those two.
So, thank you for the opportunity. We thought this was a really great time to actually go back in history and kind of look at and provide background for really this partnership that we entered into with the Chelan County PUD back in 1999-2000. So, as a bit of background, for those of you who are here may remember that at the end of that decade, we were entering into a period of time where we were pulling out Red Delicious Orchards, we were losing JanSport. We were really worried about the economic climate in our community and what were we doing as a region to tackle that. And so the city took the lead in putting together a partnership to do the high-performance community strategy. Brought in Delore Zimmerman and did a very grassroots-based look at what does this region need to do to be resilient, and came up with 16 strategies in the high-performance community strategy. And there was a role for each of the partners in this effort. It was all of our economic development entities, it was the cities, the counties at this time, our college, each had a role in the resilience of our community. And the city's role was activating our community and activating our waterfront, recognizing that for our future economic development, this was going to be a place that people wanted to live. And we had an amazing partner in the Chelan County PUD because you were, at that point, deploying your fiber network. And that fiber network is second to none in terms of providing a place by which people can come here and live in this wonderful place and operate anywhere in the world. So when this high-performance community strategy happened, the PUD brought in John White to do a study to look at your parks and how could your parks be an impetus to help and how could your parks handle more people and be a part of the fabric of the community. And so the PUD at that time approached the city and asked, how can we help you? We will help pay for that process, $120,000, for a comprehensive update to our waterfront plan. And so this process was undertaken in early 2002. Grassroots process, over 500 people participated, numerous community meetings, numerous visioning meetings with developers to look at what is the future of our waterfront. And what did the public desire? So through this process, we learned that the public desired, of course, more access to the water, both from the city side and from the PUD side. The public wanted adjacent commercial activities, and so this is actually a rendering of the bottom of Arondo Street there above the boat basin. And I think in the context of what was heard at that time is the loop trail that has been developed is a tremendous asset. And that if we look as a region at our loop trail, the public wanted different experiences along the loop trail. So our waterfront was the opportunity to offer that urban experience. As you travel along the trail, you have rural experiences on the other side of the river, and so it was important for the public to maintain that. Again, the opportunity for residential, and this is just brought home in our current planning that we're doing, looking at the housing crisis. we had a study done that shows that we have wonderful capacity in three-bedroom, two-bath houses, but we have a tremendous mismatch that is ongoing currently and is reflected in our vacancy rate, that the 60% of our households are one- and two-person households and are looking for a different housing experience. So I should also mention that these are the exact slides that were used for your commission in 2005 when we were coming back to you with the plan and looking at adopting the plan that was then followed with the zoning that provides the legal framework for how things develop. And I should also mention that as we went through this process as partners with the PUD, we did come back to you in advance of the MOU that you have in front of you today. Andy Wendell at that time actually put together a beautiful presentation that was presented both to our city council and to your commission that looked at the ways that our two entities work together. Because as Steve will take you through this process, we work together on updating all of the electrical infrastructure in the waterfront in order to serve the future development. So again, comments about the desired development from the public side. So seeking development that provides visual access to the water, includes distinctive features, provides opportunities to mix park and commercial activities, that doesn't compromise the loop trail's function and doesn't lose the intimate atmosphere of the park. So it speaks to that whole experience. And so what's really fun is to look back on that plan government is often chuckled at for doing lots of planning and having it sit on the shelf. This is a plan that has been worked diligently because the city has seen this as our economic development program. And so the reinvestment since 2004 has been $162 million, and there's another $100 million in the pipeline. And so if you look at the South Node, the day-use dock, the Thurston Street improvements, the Worthen Street improvements, reconfigured Arondo Street, mixed-use development, trail enhancements, the relocation of our public works, that's all been accomplished. The Central Node, the implementation of Riverside Drive, the farmers market ended up in our South Node. That's perfect. That's the way planning happens sometimes. We looked at an amphitheater in the park, in that central node of the park, and that is in the plan. Looked at mixed-use development with a hotel. And then in the north end, coordinated residential and commercial development, the realignment of Walla Walla and Holly, those things are coming, actually further invigorated by the fires, the Sleepy Hollow fires that gave us a palette of 30 acres to work with in the North Wenatchee area. So again, pictures from that time. So the existing frontage on Arondo, visuals that were shown at that time, proposed Riverside Drive, the proposed frontage. So everybody at that time was going into it with eyes wide open that we were really trying to provide an urban framework for our park system. And also at that time in 2006, if you'll remember, the development that was proposed. So on the left was the Riverside condominiums that were proposed by Blodgett Construction at that time. And on the right is the newest development, just three stories that will happen in that same location between 5th and 9th. Again, the picture on the lower left and the Riverside 9 development. So actually what happened with the economic downturn in 2009 is that the type of development that could have happened in 2006, in my mind, was kind of right-sized because the intensity of what has actually materialized is much less than what was anticipated at the time. And so now I'm going to hand it off to Steve, who will walk through the implementation and look at the parking issues that we've been dealing with. So.
Sure. So what shapes a plan while on the ground? The public has a role in the public infrastructure. As Allison mentioned, one of my favorite times working at the city is working with Andy Wendell in doing the Riverside Drive LID, the Walla Walla substation development, and that partnership. It was a wonderful partnership. And we had a lot of work done that set the infrastructure up, both in terms of transportation and utilities. Private investment, the plan anticipated over 1,400 units of residential, 155,000 square feet of commercial, and 155,000 of office and 96,000 of commercial. So again, pretty aggressive plan, probably about 30-40% there. It's a 20-year plan, and you know we're probably going to be a little bit shy at 20 years, but we're making a good run at it. And I think this is, you know, this is, we're now in implementation, and when rubber meets the road, this is where you got to figure out the details of how to make all this work. But in general, the plan is being followed quite well, and it's encouraging to see this. So what shapes private investment? Comprehensive plan, waterfront sub-area plan, which then translates into code. And code really hits four main areas: building size and form. We have limitations on size, heights, and what the building looks like, landscaping, parking, and then building codes. So that really governs how private development happens. Also, public-private partnership. So we're doing, Pybus Market is an example of a public-private partnership. The parking garage we're going to talk about is an example of a public-private partnership. It's where the city can engage the private in a part, and we get a little bit more control out of the outcome when we have dollars at the table. So that's a very intentional strategy that the city's engaged in. And then the economics or market realities. The 2008 collapse changed things, and now we're seeing in this housing market, what can this region really support? So I just want to be right up front and talk about parking perceptions. That the best thing to address perceptions is data, is to provide data. So I want to go through a little bit of data. And we had Rick Williams out of Portland, who's done parking studies all over the West for small towns, big cities. And here's a couple of quotes. First of all, like the mayor said, parking is an emotional subject. Everybody experiences parking, therefore they're experts. When you drive to Cafe Mela and you see that parking stall as you're going by, I'm going to get a little bit closer. You go by, gosh darn it, now I got to go around the block. I missed it, you know. It's an emotional experience. And then Wayne, which I got his name spelled wrong. Wayne is right. Wayne Wright told us in a training about the 311 rule. A negative experience, you propagate that 11 times. A positive experience, 3 times. So when you experience a parking problem, it gets accentuated, and everybody feels that. So what we did is we did a parking study, which I'll share, because data helps curtail, it helps us understand what's real and what's not. So from a city perspective, it's also important to know what drives the city financially and socially. And vitality, economic vitality, is the key to generating tax revenue that pays for police services, roads, and so on and so forth. So that is our rate. You know, you guys collect utility rates and sale market power sales. We used our land base as a form to create energy or create income and vitality for our community. This is a picture of downtown present day. Thank God, Google. Thanks for Google Earth. Here's what it was in 1940. So we've had economic vitality before. Let me toggle that. Just pick out a couple parking lots that are there. That's Wenatchee 1940s. That was economic vitality. Look at all the angled parking up and down the streets. In response to the malls, we came in, we leveled buildings, and we reduced the vitality of downtown. And struggling now, and we need to build it back up. So not saying there shouldn't be parking. There will be parking. Parking garages are the next step. But I wanted to show that's the goal of a city, is to achieve that kind of vitality that we once had here. Pretty amazing. Here's the picture of the mall behind JCPenney's. 38% of the city's revenue comes from sales tax, 27% from utility tax, and 13% from property tax. Parking lots do not provide utility tax or sales tax, and they provide very, very little property tax. So they do not drive an economy. They don't drive the revenue system for a city. Nevertheless, parking is absolutely required. It's a necessity. And so cities, you can read about Portland, the big cities, you can read about small cities. They are always struggling with what's the right size of parking. Too much parking lot kills a city, not enough also kills business. So right sizing it is absolutely critical. And that's not easy to do. And it creates consternation. It goes back and forth. I'm not going to read all this. I just want to highlight the purpose of our parking code. Require off-street parking proportional to needs. So that's off-street, meaning the private parking lot. Enhance safety for pedestrians. Provide for efficient land use. Maximize the use of the land. That's kind of what I've been describing. consider the vision for the surrounding area. A waterfront that would be a sea of asphalt parking lots would not be consistent with the vision and complementary to the park. We've got to find that balance. Reduce vehicle from an environmental standpoint. Cities are driving hard to reduce the amount of impervious surface and contamination through stormwater, reduce the heat reflection. So trying to, again, look at it from all different perspectives. But number one is require the right amount of parking. So I just want, that's the purpose in our city code that tries to implement the plans. So in our city code, there's two ways to address parking. One is through prescriptive code compliance, means you go to a table and you look up the numbers and you just provide that many parking stalls. That's the way 99% of all developments are done. And there are, in the codes, there are allowances for reduction, as Dan said, for transit or adjacency to parking lots. Those allowances are not something the city gets the grant, gets to choose. Those allowances are provided and developers have that option. We don't get to prohibit those allowances. Those are there to them. It's not a city choice on granting or not. They meet the code, they get them. We don't get any say in that. And then the other thing we try to do is look for shared parking opportunities. Having empty parking lots where there's complementary uses is a good way to efficiently use parking. That's all allowed for in the code. That's at the developer's discretion, and the city just has to make sure that it meets the code.
Steve, can I?
Sure.
Just wanted to make sure I was clear on what you just said a moment ago. Like the variances that we're looking at on the what we talked about are, in essence, automatic if criteria are filled, and it's not a choice that the city imposes.
That's correct. The one area that we have some discretion is in the alternative parking analysis, which at Riverside 9, which I'll talk about that.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, but those are just givens. If they have a transit stop there, they get that reduction. And what's interesting is most of the time the reduction's applied, and you'll see that they actually provide a little more parking. So there's also a market base. Hilton knows how many stalls they need. National corporate will tell them. And then the second way, so if you don't use prescriptive, is alternative parking compliance, and it's a way to right-size parking based on actual parking demand. Don't try to interpret the figure on the right, but just know that's a picture of the Castle Rock Apartments. It was the biggest apartment complex in our city at 140 units, and what we noticed is most of the parking stalls, most of them are covered, were empty day and night. And so that told the on bigger units, when you have averages and you have, you know, you have turnover on bigger numbers of units, it doesn't, the prescriptive code may not apply. And that's why Riverside 9 did an alternate parking analysis. So just to dispel some myths, one we just talked about, city has not and does not violate the city code and approval process. There's not a discretional thing there for us to make decisions on. The city advocates for projects to comply with the city code and meet those intents of those purpose statements. City cannot require greater than the minimum code requirements. Parking efficiency and right sizing is encouraged. Parking is an implementation tool of the comprehensive plan. So just kind of going back to those things, there's a lot of rumors out there that the city's out there violating the code, and that's a no-no. We don't, that gets you in court real quick. We don't do that. The city code requires interpretation, and those tables sometimes don't list, and I'll give you an example where they don't list some of the uses, so you have to come up with an interpretation. But we're not granting variances or granting reductions. So the areas of park, I won't hit on this, you already covered it. We'll go through these real quick. Town Toyota, prescriptive code minimum with transit reduction, as I said, that's an automatic, was 914 stalls. On site, there's actually, I think there's 608, but 600 stalls on site. There's shared 388 stalls shared with the PUD in the parks, and 321 shared with Shopko. Town Toyota Center, since then, has also secured agreements with Bluebird and Stamil. And you also know they've run shuttle from Pivus, and they've done various things to try to discourage people parking at the center. Nevertheless, on those weekends, it's busy. It's intense, just like 4th of July. It's intense. We're not quite as bad as 4th of July. But.
And also the intent there was to, in the development of that facility, to spread the parking out so that you have people walking to the other uses that are adjacent. So they might walk and enjoy a retail or a restaurant establishment and then go to the event.
And that's why Walla Walla Street was rebuilt with the event center. Because if you remember, Walla Walla was kind of had a dirt track mud mess down there. So it was rebuilt. So the area around Riverside 9. So this has been a lot of focus area. I live there and I watch this stuff daily. So even to this day, after 2 years, I still watch the parking because I'm curious. The prescriptive code minimum with transit reduction was 437 stalls, or about 1.4 stalls per unit. Alternative parking analysis provided approval of 330 stalls. So they did a bunch of studies, brought engineers, brought the Institute of Traffic Engineering manuals in, and said for this unit, 330 stalls is enough. So they approved that, and the beauty, we worked with at the time, and it was, they developed the safety mechanism, which was a planning commission approval process. This is where we do get to have say. And in that process, because the PUD commented, because we were working hand in hand, we developed a relief valve and created this ability to create more parking if it was needed. As it turns out, they actually built not 330, they built 401 stalls from the get-go. So they built more parking than they actually was required by the analysis. And they built that from the get-go, and that ends up being 1.28 stalls per unit. So they're working on right now a study, and I actually saw the preliminary results, and it turns out, you won't believe it until you see it and actually walk around there, at 1 in the morning when that's the most of the parking is full because of people are there, there's actually about 1.26 stalls per unit are being used. A lot of empty spaces. I can vouch for that. I've never had a problem finding a spot. That does not solve parking management. Having enough spaces and parking management have to go together. And so that's where we're seeing, even when there's people parking in the dirt lot across the street, almost always there's plenty of spaces on the street. And people are doing that for convenience. It's just, there's a parking management issue there. I will agree to that. There's parking management. There's not actually too much parking spaces. So that's, again, it's a perception issue. Go out and count it yourself. Walk around there at 5 in the morning. You'll see how many spaces are open.
And, so, and we'll have the study available.
And the study will be available. Working with Dan to, he'll get a copy of it. And I know that Riverside 9 actually wants to build a few more stalls because they want it easier for their managers. But the facts are is it was about right sized, I can't remember, the PUD provided the list of how many times they had to tag cars and it was not that many. It's really easy to tell because there's fog in the windows in the morning. That's the simple way to tell, and it doesn't happen very often.
Steve, doesn't that really speak to the issue of having overflow parking for the new Hilton Hotel on the other side of the railroad tracks? I mean, you just made the comment that people are parking where it's convenient.
That's exactly right.
Yeah.
Let me get to that slide, Gary, I'll show you. So I already covered that. This is the study. Riverside, the next Riverside, I won't spend much, the next set of apartments, they're going to build 1.43 parking stalls per unit. So they're building in more parking, which is going to be more than they need. That's okay. They wanted to do that on their own. They were only required to do 180 stalls. They're doing 204 on their own. The brewery, small tasting room brewery. It's mostly a brewery. Parking code was 5 stalls. They did 5 stalls. You can argue all day long, maybe our parking code wasn't right there, but that's what they implemented. And that's where the brewery is. Catholic Family was a humanitarian service. They did not have that listed in our code. So when they got a conditional use permit, they had to do an estimate for the number of parking stalls. They estimated that they needed 30. They provided 39, and guess what? That wasn't enough. And working well with PUD staff, because they were parking in the park, you guys remember, they've now created another 39 stalls. 38, and now that problem is pretty well taken care of. Once in a while, I'll see somebody parked over in the park, but most of the time, So that was a case where city worked through the implementation of conditional use permit to help solve a problem. And that thanks to the PUD staff for working with us. Hilton, Gary. This is a 176-room facility. The prescriptive code minimum is 140. And they are providing 169 that was required by a corporate, that they had at least 169. So they're building more than they're required. And they used the shared parking both for transit reduction, or they had the parking lot across the hotel. So they get either one. It doesn't matter. You just have to have one, and you get the 20% prescriptive reduction. What's going to happen here is there's two things. One is, the Hilton is going to cater heavily to convention center traffic, so we actually do anticipate that people will park in the convention center and walk back and forth. That was actually a strategy in getting the Hilton there next to the bridge, to the walking bridge. The other thing is, I'm going to show you where we're adding a parking garage that will also help them. The one thing that we're doing as a city and that cities do is we provide public parking to try to help with some of these peaking issues. And that's why we did Worthen Street, why we did River Road.
I think that speaks specifically to the MOU that we developed with you when we talk about maximizing parking, because knowing that developers, the legal basis is the code, then maximizing is on the city's part. What can we do on street? What can we do in other spaces? And so we've been actively working that and developing the funding sources for that.
And the Hilton is going to... You will see with the Hilton probably 10 weekends a year that there's a softball tournament or something or a convention in town that couples up with a farmer's market. Yeah, it's going to be busy. The rest of that time, that parking lot will probably be 80% full. And so, again, how much do you build parking for Easter Sunday at church? No. You build parking for, you know, you try to hit like the 85th percentile, and then you realize that you've got a few times a year you're going to have challenges. And that's what our code is trying to do. Did that answer your question, Gary?
It did.
The Hilton. Okay.
Yeah.
Harvest Market prescriptive code was 100 stalls, 4 per 1,000 square feet per 25,000 square foot facility. They actually built 128. And then Mike Walker, the lot to the south, bought that, and he's actually going to make sure that that's reserved for additional parking. So that was a nice gesture on his part because he thinks it's necessary for the market. Now I'll talk just briefly about downtown parking study. Interesting, in 1960, there were 7,500 parking stalls, and today there's about 7,500 parking stalls between 5th. This includes the PUD, this parcel. PUD, waterfront, all the way down to about Kittitas Street. And if you were to put that all in one parking lot, that'd be 50 acres of parking, 6 city blocks, if it was all in one single parking lot. That gives you a sense of how many parking stalls is in downtown, 7,500. About 1,800 of those are street parking stalls. This was a map, so the one on the left shows red, that's a Saturday parking utilization, which means you're at 85% or greater, the red spots. The one on the right is a Thursday parking, and green shows 30% or less. So common sense, we see this. Weekends, this was happened to be chili cook-off weekend at Pivus. Heavy parking, weekdays pretty much empty. On the waterfront in the between 5th Street and Thurston Street, there's just about 972 parking stalls. 204 of those are on the street. The rest are either PUD parks, Little Railroad, or private spots. There's a lot of parking down there already, over almost 1,000 stalls, and we're building more. So the MOU, Dan hit the principles. I won't go over that again. We agree completely with the principles as he laid them out. The MOU was entered into because the city was anticipating getting LRF funding, and we were looking for ways to invest that LRF funding, which is tax rebate funding, to the tune of about $10 million is what we have total or have had. And out of that MOU, we did an agreement with the PUD to do River Road. So city now maintains River Road, which is down by the boat launch. We built in one, made it one way from halfway to the south and put a bunch of parking spaces in, and we maintain the landscaping on the private side of that road. So in the spirit of reducing or not impacting the PUD's operation, we overlaid the road with city money, we restriped it for parking, to add parking, and we take on the maintenance. So we absolutely agree. We think that was a great example of a partnership agreement where we used LRF funds. The city actually gave us a loan to do LRF funds. It was absolutely excellent. I think the outcome was good. And so that we like that. We'd like to do more of those type of agreements. Dan mentioned we put 117 stalls on Worthen Street. We invested at Worthen Street. Didn't used to have parking the whole way. It was a hodgepodge. You remember the holes right on the edge of the pavement. It was a mess down there. So we added a bunch of stalls on the street. And then this is the two areas. The big square, the big rectangle is about a 114 stall parking garage with 36 stalls that will be shared on weekends. So we'll have 150 new parking spaces for public. And then the area up above under the bridge, we actually think we can get maybe about 40 stalls under the bridge. That'll be where the hotel does over, I would agree, aside from when there's convention use of that. So I think that's again investing in the LRF, using LRF funds to invest in parking to help mitigate any issues with parking in the park. We're looking at potentially building the garage next year through a public-private partnership. We've entered into a memorandum of understanding with that property owner. And then I believe, Rob, was it next year that under the bridge? Same thing. So, yeah, next year. There's about, there'll be about a 3 or 4 month period there where we're building parking garages and the farmer's market's going. It'll be a little bit tough for 3 or 4 months. Fair warning. We'll have to have some extra signing, extra management.
Steve is not trying to get my landmarks. Is the parking garage next to the old Golds, but between Schroeder's?
Yeah.
Right in there?
Right in there.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you.
And they have to have parking, so we're not displacing their parking. That's where the shared parking comes out. The gym will still have their parking under on the first floor of the
garage. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Good. Thank you.
It's about a $3 million garage. It's about all we can handle right now. And then the other area, we're working on Linden Tree with the PUD. We're working on the design. So Linden Tree, we expect somewhere between 60 and 100 parking stalls, depending on the configuration. The PUD did 3 design alternatives. And so that'll be nice for park users on busy weekends. I do anticipate, I think parking is, as the city grows and the waterfront develops out, parking management is the next step for the city. We don't do parking meters. We just do ticket writing. Parking management actually gets into more active participation in like a bigger city.
Steve, I'm not as familiar with it. Is that the boat club or the boat building right there? And, okay.
Paddle club, yeah.
Paddle club.
That was part of the city moving. We actually used to use that for our sand pile. I don't know if you remember. We had our boneyard there. We moved out of there.
Yeah, it's my understanding that's going to be asphalted. Is it going to be fenced, or is event parking, or is it available daily, or what are the thoughts behind that?
The parking would be available for park users for daily parking. Yeah. And I think that the vision of the plan, I'll use my mom as an example. She took a walk, parked at Walla Walla Point Park, walked down the trail, and jumped into Glaze for lunch. You know, that's the vision, is that kind of interaction. There will be, as our community grows, it will be more of a fight for the private folks with park people, park users parking in. So Steve Robinson the other day said, hey, some folks were down here parked at Fibus, and they took their kayaks down and jumped in the river, never went in the building, right? So we're going to see that a little bit both and both. And it's just the nature of the
building. I think this intermediate time period has been the build-out. And so always the build-out is the time where there's the angst, because we're not quite there yet. And but the plan is in place to have both the private and public participating in adding the parking that's needed.
I love our visits. And in the 2000 time frame, you know, you're trying to project what's going to happen. So the fishermen are there at 5 in the morning before the farmer's market using the boat launch. Farmer's market shows up. Fishermen leave. Water skiers come in, right? And then there's a little bit of overlap. And, you know, the PUD put out wonderful signs that, you know, that this is boat parking only. And that really worked well last year. I think this year we had the police were down there a few times. Right?
Yeah. I mean, it's kind of a humorous story, but a person, 3 cars parked. Well, there were 3 of the boat pieces all parked, 3 deep. And somebody in the middle got, you know, isolated, couldn't get out, were really irritated. So they called Wenatchee PD, who, because they'd gotten into it with a person who had blocked them. You know, so Wenatchee PD shows up and it's like, let's take a look at these signs. You know, so what are you telling me? And they were like, oh, I had no idea. But anyway, but it's always going to be that way.
It'd be wonderful. So the PUD, your public relations team has been doing wonderful ads about etiquette on the trail. You know, it would be wonderful to work in partnership to talk, you know, about here's the available parking and those sorts of things. So maybe there's some great opportunities so that we can really start getting into the parking management end of something. So.
And we're talking about a little shuttle going back and forth into downtown to help get private traffic into downtown on those Saturdays as well. So I went through that really fast, and forgive me, if you want to scroll back to a slide, we can certainly do that.
Commissioners, your desires, your thoughts?
That was helpful. Thank you.
I think this was incredibly helpful. I'd like a couple of comments for all 3 of you. As a new commissioner in January of 2007, all of your preliminary that you talked about had been discussed with a previous group of commissioners. I find this incredibly helpful in understanding the big picture. And I think that's really, really important. And I just want to say thank you. I'm still processing what I've heard and what I've seen. I promise that I won't throw any bombs for the next few weeks anyway. So, but this has given me a whole different picture on where you've been going. And it's very much appreciated. So thank you.
I think it's an incredible story to talk about a PUD that looked at your park as a way for our region to deal with a community that was really worried about our economic prosperity. And the PUD stepped forward at that time to make sure that we launch into this planning together. I think it's a great story to tell.
Yeah, 4 million visitors help.
Absolutely.
Well, and you guys do a wonderful job with that park. It's so beautiful. And to have 100% public access, you know, Bremerton and other places would just die to have that. So we feel really lucky and fortunate for the parks and the public power benefit that's created.
I'd just like to echo Commissioner Smith's comments that this has been really educational to learn background and history that occurred before I became a commissioner and understand how the process has taken place over time. And from what I can tell, you've kept pretty true to the original vision of how you were going to build it out. And I still remember my wife and I moved here in 1994 from Seattle. And I still remember saying, they've got a junkyard on probably the most expensive part of riverfront, waterfront that any other city would die to have. So I'm glad to see it change and develop. It looked very attractive.
Yeah, I guess I'd like to propose going from here. We have staff members this morning that have heard our presentation, our thoughts, our concerns. They've heard your presentations, your thoughts, your concerns, your progress moving forward. And I would like to have them have the opportunity to kind of distill what's been heard. If they have questions of us, please ask, and we'll put together, you know, our collective thoughts. And maybe on the other end, if you could do the same, we can find that mutual area that we're looking for. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Frank, thank you. Appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks, Frank.
And be careful about complimenting Andy too many times during the presentation. Once you guys do that, then we got to live with him. Long day.
Complimented Chad, too. Chad gave us a whole new appreciation for how beautiful your big new blue land is. Those were an appropriate part of our waterfront development.
Yeah. And we trust us. We treasure those.
So Frank, do you think it's clear sailing now to the championship game? I see you're proudly wearing your.
Working on it. Hey.
First thing about being purple and gold, it could be Wenatchee High School.
So, Commissioner, thank you very much. I was traveling Saturday and only got through half of my recorded game. Now I know the outcome.
Oh, I'm sorry.
And if you inspect parking at 5 a.m., you're going to have to do it without legal representation.
Yeah, I thought that was a little early for me. All right, commissioners, moving on. Any at substation property? Lorna, please.
Andy Wendell will update us on the status of the conversations with the city of Eniat regarding a site for a future substation, and we are falling behind time, so if we can all keep it pretty crisp, I think that would be great.
Sure. Good morning, commissioners. thank you for having us this morning. We're here to give you an update and staff recommendation on the acquisition of property for a future substation in Eniat. So today we're not asking for any formal actions. However, pending the outcome of this discussion and your thoughts, we would certainly like to bring a resolution forward as early as potentially the next board meeting to secure this property. I'm really happy to be presenting this today with my colleague Chad Rissman. Before we get started, I do want to acknowledge a few folks in the audience. We've got Mayor John Ault, Mayor of the City of Eniat. And I think that's Greg Becker back there from the City of Eniat Economic Development Committee. Is that correct? Okay. So certainly invite your participation today as audience members. We're excited because we recognize the importance and the value of doing a partnership with the City of Eniat, not only to secure a substation location for future growth and expansion, but really that partnership to help understand their visions on a move-forward basis and what infrastructures would be required from the PUD to support that. So that's really the spirit behind this presentation, is really just acknowledging that this was a partnership with equal accountability to what we're trying to do here. We'll talk a little bit about technical and operational feasibilities of the property so you get a good understanding that we feel pretty good about the property from its ability to do what it needs to do for us now and in the future. We've got a couple of points in a tentative agreement that we'll share with you and a little bit more about our staff findings. So, you know, again, I just want to emphasize that we have had some history over the last, I would say, 36 months with trying to acquire substation properties, and we applied a lot of lessons learned to this process through there. But I think the real success factor here is the partnership with the City of Eniat, where the PUD was focused on our long-range growth and planning, our operational constraints with the existing infrastructure, and the city sharing with us their growth projections and their overall city vision. Those things together really culminated into this understanding of the need for utility infrastructure to support that growth and expansion. And together, not independently, but together, we were able to explore options and walk through a lot of those options and essentially reach alignment between the city and the PUD. It certainly is a model that we would like to do and follow similar process with the other municipalities. Just really quickly, a few of the lessons learned. We know that we need to engage early and often. That means looking for infrastructure siting many years prior to when we need it. We learned, again, a lot about the city's vision, particularly along their riverfront. Applying long-term planning thoughts. We heard that loud and clear over the last 2 years with municipalities. We need to be thinking longer term. Instead of over the next 10-year horizon for electric needs, we need to be thinking 30, 40, 50 years. And this particular site acquisition, as we walk through, you'll see that this should meet our projected needs for the next 50 years in the INEAC area. Chad and his team spent a lot of time talking about the size of the properties. If you look at the existing substation site in INEAC, you'll see that it's very small in comparison. Small means that we're very limited in our expandability of that existing substation. Today, the engineers and Chad's team have developed a standard that allows us not only to meet today's needs, but to meet tomorrow's needs with that same piece of property, and we'll talk a little bit about that later. So it's a big lesson learned. We spent considerable amount of time with the City of INEAC, their staff, and a lot of public members up there talking in terms of why do we need a substation and what does it actually do for the community. And I think through that process, a lot of folks expressed an understanding that we do need these properties and we do need this infrastructure to support the future growth and expansion. Without the property, the city can't grow. Without the substation, the city can't grow. We also stayed on a very rigid time frame. We didn't want to go through another 36 months of meetings and that. So we set milestones. We held to them, and that was very effective. Also clarifying the roles and responsibilities. Certainly, we did a lot of work in this process and studying, but so did the city. They stepped up as well. So we were able to clarify our roles and responsibilities early, and just joint accountability. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to Chad, walk us through the next few slides on the technical feasibility of the property.
So I'll hit this fairly quickly in the interest of time. So if there's any follow-on questions, please be sure to let me know. We got together with the City of INEAC and did some joint planning, and we looked at their plans, which are fantastic and very interesting. We learned a lot of things, as Andy mentioned, about where they would like to go in terms of growth and where the growth would be. And a lot of it's focused in on the riverfront area. PUD has been taking actions along that plan with the city here recently too. So we made an assessment through that workshop that there was going to be a greater need. The existing substation is located sort of on the downriver side of town there. As Andy mentioned, the footprint is quite small. We would need to expand properties if we were going to expand the size of that. It's operating right now just over 10 megawatts. It's only a 14-megawatt substation, so it's half the size of our standard substation. 4 megawatts or less doesn't give you a lot of opportunity to growth. Could be consumed quite quickly, especially given the opportunities that exist in INEAC with growth and available properties and the great plan that they have put together. So we looked at several options that we worked with the City of INEAC on. One was expanding the properties there, and there were viable options for that. There was the option of the ball fields. There was also an option that was for sale that was just upriver from the ball fields. And, looking at all the various options there, we thought that the site that was north of the ball fields had the best options and alternatives for us to be able to serve what City of INEAC's long-range plan. So this is 20 to 50-year plans. We think is going to be somewhere around 56 megawatts, which is a substation with two banks in it. So we would only start when it was needed on a single bank and then have the ability to be able to expand. In this plan, I just wanted to mention that the distribution would no longer need the facilities at the existing substation. And over time, we would work on transferring all the loads and things over to the new station so that could become available. A little bit more on the site, some notable attributes that we always look for. It's close to transmission. What does the adjacent properties look like? There's a significant amount of commercial and light industrial there, so it's a little bit more conducive to the substation than complete residential. You can see that though on the west side of the road, there is residential there. We've been in contact with most of those property owners and have made presentations of the same here. We're looking for interested parties and also landscaping opportunities here at the site. It's close to our load center, in other words, where the city wants to grow. And so we feel like some infrastructure reductions could be a result of that being close to and in proximity to where the growth is. City Council, in fact, last Thursday voted to support this location. The property was for sale. As I mentioned before, the district is in a purchase and sale agreement that expires on October 9th. We would like to execute on that purchase and sale agreement, so we'll get to part of that. And again, this property would allow us to expand up to what we think ENIAC will ultimately need. Street view of the property, you can see the adjacent transmission. It's available property, no encumbrances currently. So sort of a greenfield design, greenfield construction, which is preferable. Another view, a little more upriver, looking down at its triangular shape there, just north of the ball fields. One of the feasibility elements that we went through to make a recommendation or determination that staff would support moving forward with this purchase and sale agreement is we wanted to make sure a substation would actually fit in this piece of property. And so you can see we modeled, engineering staff modeled a mobile substation in and out, various accesses. We took this back to the city and showed them these plans. We worked with them on what agreements we would need in the future in terms of ingress, egress to this site. You can see on the right-hand side there, there's a shaded area. There's quite a Shamel Street there Wisdom Street has quite a large right-of-way, and the city a number of years ago had plans for, or there was thought of a bridge actually going across the Columbia River from what we heard from the city. That is no longer in the vision, and so there's an opportunity there likely to utilize some of that right-of-way if needed and pending final design. So we have tentative agreement that we coordinate with the city to work with ingress, egress, and maybe some additional square footage there along Wisdom Street. You can vaguely see the substation layout sort of behind this text here. What we'd like to do, I think, is move this a little bit further south, and so that would change. We're cutting a little close here to some of the electrical infrastructure and the slope, so we'd like to widen this out. So if we're able to move in this direction a little bit, that would be very helpful. But that'll be pending final design.
Okay, so just wrapping up, we want to just give you an idea of some of the terms that we have tentatively agreed to with the City of ENIAC, and as Chad mentioned, their City Council adopted or agreed to these terms. And we would incorporate these into a final agreement. One of the unique things about this is that we don't know exactly how the substation will lie on the property. Until we do a final design, thus we don't know exactly how much of the city right-of-way we would need to acquire until that final design is completed, and that will likely happen later this year and throughout 2019. But essentially, we've agreed to move forward, the PUD would move forward with the purchase of this property and looking to that final design to answer some of those additional questions. The support from the city, these are just general terms, but, you know, the city has expressed that this is their preferred site for the PUD location. We have a need to access Highway 97 for that mobile sub, as Chad showed. We'll transfer portions, only what's needed, from the Wisdom Road right-of-way after the final design. And that the landscaping would be done through a collaborative process. So we'll get the engineers to do the technical design, and then we would facilitate a discussion with community members of ENIAC and look at options for landscaping, possibly hire a landscape architect to come in and work with those folks on that. I think they're very interested in that. I think I understand they have a tree board that helps manage, you know, aesthetics from landscapes in the city, and we would invite them to possibly participate in that. So, and there's a few small utility relocates associated with that. Support from the PUD, we obviously we continue to work with the city to transfer that ball field property. The community values that property for recreation opportunity in that area, and they've expressed interest in maintaining that as a ball field and making improvements in that. PUD does own that property, and we're working with them on alternatives for them to acquire those ball fields as well. We have the existing substation that once this new substation is built, and Chad has indicated over some period of time that we would vacate that property of the existing substation, and we'll certainly work with the city on what use that would be. Collaborating on the transmission and distribution, and collaborating on the landscaping. So on a timeline, it's our last slide, on the timeline here, we've gone through that engineering and operational feasibility. We've got a green check there. The engineers are okay with that. Pending the final design, we'll need additional right-of-way. We've got that agreement. A final presentation with the City Council was done on September 11th. And again, last week, I think it was on the 13th, they approved that. We're here today on the 17th, informal presentation. To take action on the October 9th deadline for that purchase and sales agreement, we would need to have that approved through resolution through the board on October 1st, which is in a few weeks. And then once the property is acquired, we can move into those final designs and that final discovery work. So that's what we've got for you today. Any thoughts or concerns, questions?
Just a question. The current site right now, could you just refresh my memory? I know you just said that would be eventually completely vacated. You wouldn't be looking at needing that in the future. It would be surplusing or what? Can you just?
Yeah, there would no longer be the need for an electrical facility there. So at that point in time, you know, we could look at, the district could look at and work with the city on whatever it wanted to do or needed to do or could do with that property. So we would just vacate it with the electrical facilities and determine the next steps.
Yeah, so Commissioner, we have a process for vacating properties, and that can include other departments and business lines evaluating it for potential need and use, and then any of those decisions would have to come to the board for approval. So there would be board action, review, recommendation, etc.
I understand that. I guess where I was leading at is just it's not part of a this new purchase would take the need and service into 50 years, and you're really not looking at holding on to that property to do anything beyond that.
So that's correct.
Thank you.
We can clarify that in the resolution too.
Please, Gary.
Has there been any contact and outreach to the warehouses on the backside by the water to discuss a substation there?
Yeah, we've spoken with the most adjacent property is the Karma processing plant, and I reached out to the owners a few weeks ago and had conversations with them. They've not expressed any immediate concerns. They did want to stay informed of the process, asked them directly if they had any immediate concerns, and they didn't. I think as we've gone through this process, clearly the aesthetics and the landscaping is first and foremost on people's minds, and we are committed to facilitating that in partnership with the city of INIA and their community.
Could just mention too, there is the public process of the conditional use permit that is a requirement that we would work with the city of INIA, so there's a public process as a part of that, including what would be conditions placed on the substation, likely landscaping and other things that we've made provisions for in this conceptual design.
Good. Thank you.
Anne, excuse me, Anne.
So speaking of partnership, may I read a letter, Mr. Chairman, from Mike Chambers?
Please. Thank you.
Mike's on the Antioch City Council, and he sent me this letter pertaining to the partnership regarding this project. Hello, Ann. This is short. It won't take very long. Hello, Ann. I just wanted to express my personal satisfaction working with Andy Wendell and Chad. Sorry, I can't remember his last name. Chad Rissman. For their professional approach and actions in connection with the City of Antioch. The two make working with the PUD very productive. Their willingness to listen and advise enables us to see visions materialize in a responsible and expedited manner. Unfortunately, I will not be able to attend your upcoming Monday commission meeting, but I want to tell you I personally am in support of the property acquisition and relocation plans for the new substation that Andy and Chad have been working on. Securing our future is greatly appreciated. Thank you, Michael. So this is wonderful. This whole thing is wonderful news. Probably 4 years ago, I can't remember, 3 or 4 years ago, it was Public Power Week, and I stopped in at the offices there in Antioch because they had those really good donuts and I forget where they got those wonderful donuts. But anyway, donuts and apple juice and just people could stop in and visit with, you know, staff about the PUD. And so I stopped in, and first thing I heard about was the new substation that's going in on the ball field. And, you know, the PUD owns that property, and so I guess the assumption was, or it was in the plan somewhere way back, that there was going to be a substation built on that property, and there was a lot of angst. I mean, every council member and the mayor talked to me about that, and I was concerned too because I've driven by that back and forth from Chelan thousands of times, and I love watching the kids play ball in that little ball field. So anyway, this came to a great compromise, and everybody seems to be happy with it. So thank you.
Now, if we can just find some squirrel-resistant landscaping, it'll be total package. Any other questions?
Yeah, you guys do a great job. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. So we would propose to bring a resolution forward in the next board meeting. I'm not asking for an approval of that right now, but certainly between now and then, if you do have any additional concerns, please let me know.
Okay.
Yes. Thank you.
Good job. And Mayor, any comments?
It's been a really good opportunity, and I mean, from the very beginning, when Andy reached out to me and brought his team in, it's been a very smooth transition. They've been able to just flex their schedules accordingly. We have a number of our folks, like on council and things, that have different schedules as well, and so can be available at different times. So they've been very accommodating to our staff and to our planning commission and to our council as well. So no, I appreciate the effort. I thought things went along quite quickly, smoothly. Obviously, I shared with Andy's team at the very beginning, we were very interested in trying to be kind of a little, maybe mini boilerplate test bed, if you will, for US. I indicated from the very beginning, I said, we're small, we're nimble, we don't take too long to make decisions. If you want to run things by us, test drive things, see what works, see what doesn't, that'll help you in your process later. As you go to some of the other municipalities that have a bit more complex structure, you know, we're glad to help. So thank you very much for your support. Appreciate it.
Thank you. Much appreciated. Gentlemen, thanks.
Okay.
Looking at our agenda, we're not going to get through all of it this morning. So what I'm suggesting is let's please take number 7, which is the fiber rates, because that also dovetails into our public hearing at 1 o'clock. And so I'd like to go there. And then we'll take a look at items 8, 9, and 10 as we approach our time.
All right. So I'd like to invite Mike Coleman to come and outline proposals for our rates for services, along with some minor clarifications and cost adjustments.
Good morning, Commissioners. Mike Coleman, Managing Director of Fiber and Telecommunications. My voice is not all here, but I will try this morning. Even though we're under a time crunch, I wanted to call attention to the pictures on the opening slide. That's our human performance operational excellence moment for the day. That's some fiber linemen doing a pre-task plan prior to actually doing the work, which is represented on the picture to the right. So why are we here today? our current business service rates for virtual local area networks were becoming non-competitive. We're proposing to refine the service offerings and lower the rates to stabilize and create additional sales. We also saw a need for two different classes of service, and the second class, carrier class VLANs, will offer term contract rates because that's almost mandatory in that world. We also needed to clarify the language associated with the rate schedule for coarse wave division multiplexing, otherwise known as CWDM services, to increase a better understanding of the product offering and to update the mileage rates. We launched that product last year, and that was instrumental in one of our service providers being able to maintain the Wenatchee School District's business. We launched it with a comparison with our dark fiber, and so now we're cleaning that up just a wee bit. Our aggregate bandwidth rate, we introduced that with the loop rates 2 years ago, and we're proposing to update the rate range to maintain pace with the increased bandwidth usage. This allows us to manage the revenue requirements in a rate-neutral manner to the retail service providers. We're also going to be informing you of an update on non-recurring charges for advanced services on fees and charges schedule per a cost analysis that was recently done. And we're also proposing, last but not least, to update our service connection policy to provide a little bit more efficiency in working with developers. And we plan to come back on October 1st and ask for approval. So I'm going to start with the VLAN service. We currently offer one class of service. As I mentioned, the rates are becoming non-competitive for the small to medium businesses. We see the market demand for two classes of service. So our strategy is to create flexibility to respond to market demand while stabilizing the revenues. The business class is one of the new services, will be a best effort service. It's described by using standard frame sizes and is delivered over the broadband network, and it's also a lower cost service. The carrier class is a dedicated service with advanced attributes. Nominally, this primarily revolves around the Metro Ethernet Forum attributes and also the capability to offer jumbo frames. These are quite often used with cell tower circuits. It's also delivered over a dedicated network. We will offer term rates for this class of service, 3- and 5-year terms. And early termination fees will apply to this service if they take the term. The service provider feedback on the business class was very consistent, the need for lower rates, particularly in the small, medium business market. We were experiencing an erosion of VLANs in this segment, and we saw them utilizing an arrangement known as a virtual private network, where they buy a DLL and put equipment on it to provide that virtual private network, and they avoid the cost of the VLAN because they viewed it as too expensive. On the carrier class, the input showed a need for term rates. They're having to sign terms with the cell tower companies, and they wanted to be able to have the stability of matching their terms. The input on the rates for the carrier class was mixed. We had one provider expressing a need for lower rates. We had other providers that said that they were very satisfied with the rates that we currently had. We did make one change there, though. So for business class VLAN rates, this applies to both the fixed and burstable services, and this is a month-to-month rate. There will be no term rates offered. You can see that the 50 megabit circuit stayed the same at $112. The 100 meg went from $499 to $149, and the 1 gig went from $999 to $399. The belief, both ours and the service providers, is that this will drive up utilization of the VLANs for the small and medium business. On the carrier class rates, again, applies to both the fixed and burstable. For the month-to-month, the 50 meg circuit will actually go up. from 112 to 158. The 100 meg circuit will stay the same, and the 1 gig circuit will drop from 999 to 899. That was the only change that we saw was necessary there. If you look at the term rates, both the 3-year and the 5-year, the 3-year represents a 15% discount from the month-to-month rate, and the 5-year represents a 20% discount. So it provides them the stability that they desire. It also provides us stability on our revenue, both through locking in the term as well as the early termination fees that they apply. So when we look at the VLAN services, and our goal was to stabilize the revenue through offering the competitive rates, the blue line is our forward forecast, our current forecast, and you can see that it was eroding and it was dropping and continuing to drop. Part of that forecast involved the fact that we knew we had to make rate changes. So by taking this action now and forecasting it out, you see the red line. Because of the term rates, it stabilizes very nicely. You'll also see that the first 3 or 4 years, our revenue is less than we previously had forecasted. Total of that 4-year period is about $453,000. Today, the VLAN revenue makes up about 8% of our total revenue. After this rate adjustment, it'll be down to 6%. With that said, if you look at our total revenue forecast, it is still in line with where it was because of growth in other areas. Mm-hmm. So you have that compensating effect there. This is something that anytime we look at market-based pricing, we're looking at not only the immediate product and the cross-elasticity, but also our total revenue picture for the program. So I'm going to shift to the Wave Division multiplexing. We did launch that. It was used very successfully to maintain the Wenatchee School District on our network. We rolled it out again with the analogy being it's a slightly different version of a dark fiber capability, and we use some of the same parameters that we did on dark fiber, and now we need to come back and change it a little bit. We want to provide a better understanding of the product offering, not only to the retail service providers, but the end customers. And in doing that, we're going to add a per pathway clarification in the rate tables. We're also going to change the description. We had used simplex and duplex, and while that is technically accurate, it can also be a little bit confusing because simplex and duplex are used in other parts of the telecom world. So we're changing it to something very straightforward and calling it a single fiber and a dual fiber. In one case, the Wave Division multiplexing is conducted over that single fiber, and the other, it is conducted over two, and you can get more pathways. We're also adjusting the mileage rate. The base rate, very similar to dark fiber, covers the first 14 circuit miles. The mileage rate applies over 14 circuit miles. So the new rates that we're proposing will provide an administrative ease in the billing process. And what happened there is we used the same mileage originally as the dark fiber. Well, when you're looking at it covering the first 14 miles of the circuit, you really want your mileage to be 1/14th of the base rate so that as they add miles, it's very easy for them to determine and for us to determine what the new rate is for them. So in this case, the single fiber will go down from 4784 to 4306. The double fiber will change from 4280 per mile to 3852 per mile. The next big subject, aggregate bandwidth. When we launched the loop rates, we had predicted that the growth in bandwidth would cause cause us to have to come back and lower this aggregate bandwidth rate in order to maintain the revenue neutrality for the service providers. We had forecasted this and expected that initial rate range would last for about 2 years. The initial rate range was 5 cents a gigabyte to 10.5 cents a gigabyte. We're proposing a new rate range of 2 cents a gigabyte to 7 cents per gigabyte. It's based on our current estimated bandwidth growth and our revenue requirement. And this rate, again, we would expect to last about 2 years unless the bandwidth just goes crazy. As you can see there, we had originally predicted that the bandwidth was growing around 36 to 40% a year. It came in pretty close to that, which was surprising because we were really worried the first 6 months. You can see a lot of change in that first 6 months after we implemented these rates. Part of that was retail service providers making adjustments in their network to lower retransmissions and other operational things, which was affecting the amount of bandwidth that was coming into and out of the network. The national trend is still there. It is consistent with what we're forecasting. Bandwidth will continue growing at 35 to 40% a year until the next killer app hits. And we're not sure what that is. So we also needed to make some changes to our non-recurring charges for the advanced services only. We performed a cost analysis related to the VLANs, the CWDM, and the dark fiber non-recurring charges. These are based on the material and labor costs that are necessary to install these services. So our proposed changes, I'm going to show you current and proposed in all cases. For the VLAN, it was $565 per port for the 50 and 100 and $1125 for the 1 gig service. Simple answer is the price of optics are changing daily and they're generally coming down. The proposed charges would go to $312.50 per port for the business class and $1,893.50 per port for the carrier class, and that simply reflects the difference in the cost of the equipment and the labor to install the different classes of service. On the CWDM, the current charge was $1,050 because it was modeled after the dark fiber. That is being updated to reflect the actual cost, which will take us into $1,887 per CWDM pathway. The dark fiber, the current charges of $1,050 are updated to $1,487. The critical dark fiber current charge of $2,100 is updated and actually lowered to $1,942. And last but certainly not least is our service connection policy. When we last updated the policy, the district was providing the conduit for developers that were pre-doing the infrastructure for their developments. We were not providing the underground fiber connection storage, otherwise known as handholds. in looking at it, and particularly using a case study where we had provided the conduit but not the handholds, we found that we were spending more money on additional materials and labor, particularly, than we would if we went ahead and just gave them the handholds, worked with them on the design, and made them accountable for implementing it to our standards. So our change there is to provide the handholds. It saves the district the labor cost. It allows the developer to then say they have a fiber-ready development, fiber-ready home. Makes it much, much easier for us to deploy fiber into that development. So I have covered a lot here. The VLANs, both the new classes, the new rates, the non-recurring charges, the CWDM, the aggregate bandwidth, and the service connection policy. We would look to come back on October 1st with a resolution for the rate schedule changes. Also on October 1st, a resolution for the service connection policy changes. And if approved, the rate changes and service connection policy would be effective January 1st, 2019. The footnote that I missed back on the non-recurring charges is that that's actually informational for the board because the general manager has the delegated authority. And so I would look to you on that particular one as part of informing you that, that if you have any questions or would like to discuss that before it is approved. All of our other existing rates will remain in effect.
Mike, thank you. Comments, questions, Steve?
One of the questions I have, Mike, is, you know, I see those rates working on our benefit to work effectively with service providers. And I'm just curious, you know, as we work to be effective with those service providers, I'm still waiting to hear from the service providers what they're doing to benefit also those low-income connections and help customers that can't afford that service. Have we heard anything more from them?
I have not. I have recently had a couple of discussions, and specifically on that topic, to say that you know, we've done a lot for them, and we've given them the flexibility. Mm-hmm. We've given them the opportunity. When am I going to see some results that are going to be good for the PUD, good for the customer owners? That is something that I will probably cover more in depth when I do kind of my end-of-year presentation in December. I would like some solid commitments from the retail service providers before I come in for that.
Because I see that we're dropping some charges here, and I'd like to see something come back as a benefit to our customers.
I agree, but I'm also looking at the cross elasticity and the impact of the district there. The changing of the VLAN rates was as much for our benefit as
theirs. Sure.
And I realize in the big picture, we're still doing a lot for them.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel very strongly about the low-cost packages for the people that cannot afford broadband. It's not something that I'm going to let drop with them.
I didn't hear what you said.
It's not something that I'm going to let drop. It's an issue that I will continue to pursue.
It's an issue for me, too.
Okay. I will pass that on to him.
I'm still waiting.
Commissioners, other thoughts? Hearing none?
Thank you.
Nice job. Appreciate you fitting in the time frame.
And, Mike, I do appreciate the glossary.
Yeah.
I said, are learning the acronyms. Thanks.
Yeah, it's interesting. Yeah. You read the glossary, and then you're still not sure what you just read, but we're glad you're around.
Thank you.
We're going to do that quickly, the Walkley Scholarship drawing, which then when we come back, we'll take the public hearing, we'll take the consent agenda, and then we will return to the agenda at 8 and 9. Briefly, the Walkley Scholarship. Walkley was a long-term employee. Upon his death, the family set up a scholarship that goes to an employee of a PUD in the state of Washington, and it's $1,000 a year, I believe, and the state association works with that grant to make sure that it remains exactly at $1,000 every year, because it's not a self-sustaining, but it's really close. So with that being said, I think the person who draws the Walkley Scholarship this year should be the person who has traveled the furthest in the most recent days. So let's take that to Randy.
Yeah. Yeah.
Only 20,000 miles.
Only 20.
Jeez.
I hope you get mileage for that.
What?
I did this time. It's partial.
You look pretty fresh.
Want me to read it?
And the winner is?
Jacob Wiersma.
Very good. Very good. Thank you. And I assume you'll take care of that. Okay, let's adjourn until 1 o'clock. See you at 1. Thank you very much. It is 1 minute past 1. It's time for our afternoon business session. And today we will be starting with a public hearing regarding the cryptocurrency moratorium. And then just so people know that if you want to stick around after that, we will pick up the consent agenda and then items 8 and 9 from this morning and continue the agenda as presented earlier today. So with that being said, Lorna, let's kick off the hearing.
Oh, I should have shared this with you. Eric is actually going to intro the...
So thanks. Sorry, Lorna. I actually think, Commissioner, you did a fine job. This is just a continued hearing on the ongoing cryptocurrency moratorium. Have some staff information today. No action required today except for the fact that we would need to, at the end, continue the moratorium to a future date. And that is actually contained in the materials. I saw that that's already been provided. There are actually two motions in there, so... And we'll be asking those at the end. Otherwise, no hard decisions on what the rate will be, et cetera, today. So.
All right. Good afternoon, Commissioners. Lindsay Mons, Business Manager and Customer Utilities. As Eric said, I'm here today to talk about the cryptocurrency moratorium. This is our next regularly scheduled public hearing on the topic, where staff provides updates on what we've been doing to the Commission and the public. So today, we'll go through an overview of the rate and phase-in recommendation. For those that weren't here at our last meeting on the 4th, we went through a great deal of detail on the rate itself, and that is available on our website if anybody's interested. Probably to the board's appreciation, we're not going to have as many numbers today. So be a little bit lighter of a discussion. We'll also talk about a rate outreach plan. So part of the next steps on this process would be to talk about rate outreach and if the board is in favor of the proposal that staff has on the table. The action today would be associated with the moratorium, as Eric mentioned, as well as a rate action or rate hearing plan. And then we'll provide time for public comment. So first of all, overview on the rate. The first element of the rate that we haven't talked about in quite a while, we talked about it very early on in the public hearings, is upfront capital charge. This is actually housed in our fees and charges schedule, not the rate schedule itself. But for awareness and for a full view of the rate, this is a portion of it. It's paid by each customer when they connect based on their connection size, so per kW. There are two elements to it, a distribution charge and a transmission charge. And these costs are associated with the infrastructure acceleration that's required when our capacity is used faster than we have in our growth plans. So this provides funding for those additional improvements that we need to make. On the distribution side of things, we're proposing a charge of $270 per kW. This is the same as we presented earlier this year. This is where capacity is available. So if there's substation capacity available, this would be the charge. We are interested and willing to consider what we would maybe term a cryptocurrency zone. If there were several customers that had loads, you know, close to what a substation would require, if those customers were to get together and bring a proposal to the district, we would consider, you know, building a new substation in an area for those. If the customers were to get together, put that, organize it, and all of that. As far as cost goes on that, based on our normal substation construction costs, that would be around $380 per kW or at whatever the cost is. So that would be a large investment. On the transmission side of things, we've talked about the Wenatchee Corridor quite a bit. That's the area from the old station monitor area down through town, down to Malaga. So we've found that we have about 100 megawatts of transmission capacity in that area. If we were to do some improvements there, to the tune of about $5.5 million. So if you spread that over the 100 megawatts, that's $55 a kW investment for customers in that area. And then all other areas, excluding north of Leavenworth, would be $450 a kW because our transmission system is really kind of on the edge of its capacity as is in those areas. So anything that's growth significantly different than what we forecasted has a big impact cost-wise. The area north of Leavenworth, this is the Summit line, transmission line that's located in forestry land and things that in order to rebuild that line, it would be extremely difficult if at all possible. So we are not allowing connections in that area unless something were to change. So, and then connections over 5 megawatts as previously handled would be based on a transmission study and actual cost there. So because these charges are housed in our fees and charges schedule and not a rate schedule itself, it's likely these will be back to you as the board in November with our annual fees and charges update. They're already included in there, and this would just be an update to the costs that are included. Then the next section on the monthly rate side of things, for the cryptocurrency rate, our rate recommendation is what we termed option two last time around. And it's a two-part or two-type of customer rate, so a non-residential or commercial industrial type rate customer, and then those that are not located in our commercial industrial areas, people that are in what our system looks like as more residential. So we've constructed our system for residential services. The difference between those two rates is really in the demand charge. The residential area has a higher demand charge because it does have more infrastructure required to serve those customers. And then also in the energy charge. So for the larger customers, certainly over a megawatt, we would be looking at a market-based energy rate that would vary with the market that we experience when we purchase power for those customers. We are looking at potentially setting that rate or fixing it for certain periods of time for the 1 megawatt and less, as well as the residential customers. What this means on an effective rate perspective, so effective rate is where you take all the different rate elements, our three-part bills, which are basic charge, demand charge, and energy charge, put some assumptions on the type of load and size of load, and create a total dollar bill and divide it by the kWh, so you get a dollars per kWh that the customer experiences. So this would be their effective rate. On the residential side of things, we're seeing our cryptocurrency customers have an average load factor of about 74%. So this graph shows that. And the effective rate for those customers in light blue, their existing rate is in the 4 to 5 cent range, depending on size. With the new recommended rate, it would increase to the 8 to 9 cent range. And then on our non-residential side of things, with the load factor, higher load factor, we see in the commercial industrial areas of 90%, these customers on their current rate are paying 3.5 to 4 cents a kilowatt hour, and that would increase to 6 to 6.5 cents. The little bumps you see at the beginning of this graph are associated with the tiered customer charge that's dependent on size. So smaller customers pay less than larger customers.
And this is independent of the upfront charges?
Correct. This does not include upfront charges. It's monthly rates only. So we recognize that this is a big step for customers of any type. And additionally, we have some risk as the district since we're right in the middle of our customer information system upgrade. So some of the elements of this rate are more complex to program into a system than being right in the middle of an implementation makes that even more error prone. So we have a rate implementation recommendation, and which is a two-step rate to be compatible with our CIS implementation as well as to recognize the impact to customers. For that rate, and this is just the monthly rate, not the upfront charge. The upfront charge would be in place already, but for the rate itself, two steps with the first step effective in April of 2019. At that time, we'd implement the new energy rate, but not the variable portion of the energy rate, just a set market proxy rate for all customers at the same amount. And then in a step two, effective in April of 2020, following our CIS go live, in a period of time for us to do that rate programming, we'd implement the variable energy portion of the rate that wasn't implemented the first time in 2019, as well as the new residential energy demand. What this does to the effective rate graphs, again, this is the residential with the 74% average load factor, is it increases the rate a little more than halfway, but about as close to halfway as we could get with the options that we had. So an increase of about 2.5 cents from their current 4 to 5 cents to a 6 to 7 cent range. So for the first step there to the yellow line, and then the second step in 2020 up to the dark blue. For the non-residential customers in the 90% load factor, the dark blue line is hidden behind the yellow line because the energy rate really is the most influential part of the rate for commercial industrial customers. But the benefit that this customer group would see in the first phase of or first step of the implementation would be that they have the deferral of that variable energy rate. So in reality, the dark blue line isn't as smooth as this shows. As the market changes, that rate will go up and down with the market. So they get some stability in that first year of rate implementation. Or predictability is another word we like to use. So from here, we'll talk a little bit about timelines. So the board process for rate changes would be for us to bring forth a rate plan with hearings and public meeting information for the board's feedback and potential approval. Our proposed rate process includes one public information hearing. We've provided a lot of information to the public in hearing form throughout this process. So we'd have one more hearing, or not hearing, an information meeting to answer any final questions, provide details on the final rate proposal, those items, and that would be in November, November 7th, out at the CTC. And then following that would be a rate hearing November 19th. So that would be where the board has the opportunity to approve or request further change to the rate. Between now and then, we would be working on developing our processes for the new groups, preparing any policy revisions that are required, draft templates, draft staff reports, all the necessary items to actually put a rate into place. And then in December, we'd come forth with a rate resolution if the board approved the rate in November. And then between December 3rd and that April 1st, first step of the rate plan, we would be providing notice to effective customers, doing the programming and testing and ensuring all the billing processes work out, and then any final policy regulation updates there. Associated with this, we'd be doing a great deal of public outreach, providing notice to the public in all the various forms that we find effective, including the newspaper article or newspaper ads on our webpage, direct mailing, social media we found to be quite effective recently, and then, of course, the normal legal notices of the hearing and whatnot in the newspaper. So from there, there's any questions from the board. I'd be happy to take those.
Lindsay, I was not at the last meeting, so maybe you spoke to this end. But so this timeline looks like you show November 19th rate/moratorium hearings. So is that when it is suggested by staff that we would consider lifting the moratorium?
That is a decision for the board to make. In the past, we have done I'm trying to remember how we did it last time. I believe last time we lifted the moratorium on the date of the rate effective date. In this case, it would be April. But we have many options there, and it's kind of what the board prefers as far as the moratorium goes. We could lift it on November 19th, we could go January 1st, we could, there are options there.
So staff doesn't have any strong feelings there in terms of the work that you have to do and the progression you have to make.
So, Commissioner, maybe I can take that one. So we need to have the rate hearing. So once the comment and outreach process is complete pursuant to the board resolution, we need to have a hearing date, public hearing date, that the board would take action on the rate. That can be, we're tentatively proposing that as November 19th. Of course, there's a lot that could unfold between now and then that could impact that, but we do need to set a date. So we would set that date as proposal. I think staff has pretty strong feelings about that date as a placeholder. And then if the board was not ready to take action or had some other questions, it could at that meeting then reset the date for a later date. At the same time, yes, Commissioner, the board will need to take action on the moratorium. It does not necessarily mean that you would Katie bar the door, lift the moratorium, but there would my expectation would be that there would be some sort of an alignment between the implementation of the effectiveness of the rate and what happens with the moratorium. So as you might recall last time, the board made a decision on what the rate would be and instructed staff to go out on the HDL side. I instructed staff to go out and begin to communicate and take steps necessary to implement that rate, but the rate wasn't actually implemented and effective until sometime later, to allow staff the opportunity to set up all the buildings, to test the process, et cetera. I expect, Commissioner, that would be the same here. There would be some need to, and it's hinted at here, phase in this rate over time, and staff will have that plan fully vetted for you at that time and go through it, probably even at an informational meeting in advance of that, so the board will be well advised. Corollary to that, does that mean with the with the moratorium? Do we want to lift it in whole, in part, begin accepting applications, processing them, but not moving people? That will be up to you.
Okay. Yeah.
And I interrupted you when you tried.
No, that's all right. The only reason I interrupted you is because I forget what I was going to say. So
you're not alone in that.
I would just forget what I'm going to just say. Wait. Yes, words. I just would like to see us at least set a date, and as you said, it doesn't have to be set in concrete. Things could change, but the people who have been following this process for many, 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 many months would like to see us do something definitive.
Right,
set a date.
And my expectation, Commissioner, was that once we have what the rate will be, we will be able to give you, and I think in advance of, but certainly at that hearing, a staff proposal on how we would propose to implement the rate and over what period of time. And as a result of that, how we would propose to begin to come out of the moratorium. As I said, we could lift the moratorium completely, which might create some practical challenges with respect to actually hooking people up and beginning to deliver service because the rate might not be effective. But like we did last time, I would expect that in some sense of it, we would begin lifting of it and a process to lift it completely so that we could begin to process the applications that are currently in the queue. Those need action. And study, we would need to begin to accept new applications and process those. All of those things require study and time, which can go on during that implementation phase of the rate. So I think we can phase that moratorium in such a manner that we can be moving forward productively with staff time and customer resource time in getting things ready to go so that when the systems will support the rate, we can literally flip the switch, they can have their power, and the rate will be effective at the same time. There's a lot of legwork that can go on before they get the power, though.
Yeah, so you're saying you can be taking these steps.
Correct.
Doing all these things, and I see you shaking your head, so you concur.
Yes.
And so essentially we haven't officially lifted the moratorium, but we're working, making real positive steps toward doing that.
So hypothetically, I'll give you this. Hypothetically, the board could on November 19th, tell staff we're going to lift the moratorium as it relates to applications and the acceptance and processing of applications so that we can begin to accept them because currently we are not. And we are not working on them, those that are in the queue. So it could be, hypothetically, that the board says we want to lift the moratorium, begin to accept applications and process those applications to do the study work that will be necessary at the distribution engineering and transmission engineering level to get things ready to go, but that we would not literally turn on those services and begin charging until the systems internal to the district are ready to handle them.
Perfect.
Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't want to presuppose what staff's recommendation or the board decision might be, which is why I posed it as a hypothetical.
But, yeah, I kept asking, and so finally it came. Yeah, that's what I'm looking for.
Yeah.
So let me concur with what I heard Ann say and what I heard you say. Customers have been patient. They've been willing to work with us and, tolerate our movement going forward because it has been a judicious process and continues to be so. But I think we need to honor that patience and the respect that has been yielded. At the same time, we have to be ready for billing, et cetera. So if we take a look hypothetically at the 19th, that might be a great time to take a look at the rate and then take a look at the moratorium on the hearing and structure that so people can begin to flesh out,
correct,
knowing what the rate is, their business plan, and give them the opportunity to be ready when we're ready to flip the switch and complete that process. So is that kind of summary?
He says it better than I do.
Yeah, but
much better.
It took both. But we need to hear from the commission. We also need to hear in terms of staff where we need to be keeping in mind that we have a responsibility, to customers to hear what it is they're saying, flesh that out, and get them down the path that they're looking forward to.
So the proposal, I think that's right, Commissioner, and the proposal then is to set that date for November 19th to make some of those decisions.
Yeah.
And I say that recognizing completely that the board has not yet even adopted the outreach plan, and we don't know what might come from that set of comments.
Correct.
So that's sort of the path, tentatively, subject, as always, to board discretion.
Sure. Okay. Is that, we okay with that? So for the public part of the hearing, are we ready to listen to what people have to share with us, please? So I would encourage people to share with us what it is that is on your mind. And because our meetings are recorded, would appreciate if you would come to the microphone, state your name, your address, and we'll provide 4 minutes of initial commentary. And should things fall into a reasonable pattern, there may be the opportunity to come back for a second bite. And we'll provide that with time provided. And we'll give you a 4-minute comment period, and then we'll go from there. So anyone wishing to address the commission, please do so. And please utilize the microphone. We can make this the shortest hearing in the world. Okay, moving on. No, just kidding. Just kidding. Come on up, please, to the microphone. Just giving you a bad time.
Hi, good afternoon, commissioners and community. My name is Roberto.
Please state your name and your
Roberto Ocampo from Wenatchee, 1244 Submission. I'm a crypto miner. I have a couple questions. An introduction. I think the moratorium started up because we started getting many demands or application requests in San Samina involved in the world. I know of crypto mining. I know that many of these big operations are already set in New Zealand and many other places already. So I don't know if based on the origin of this moratorium, many of these requests maybe are already gone. And the prices are being suggested based on those requests and those demands. And I'm pretty sure that many of these big operations are already set in another place. So I wonder if your expectations are still the same as it was many, many months ago. I have that big question. And then second question will be based on the application I submit many months ago that I paid for the study, and based on what the attorney has said, it means that there is no progress on those applications. I mean, it means that I may have to wait another year to have what the estimation going to be for that. Because I already paid $3,000 on top of the application, and it's been sitting down, maybe doing nothing. I don't know. I would like you guys to review those kind of questions as well and give us a chance. I'm a micro miner, I will say. Thank you.
So I can provide clarity to the second question, which is the board's moratorium did stop work on any of the applications that had been filed. They were not rejected. We have had some, I understand, applicants who have asked for their deposits back, and we've honored those requests and taken those applications out of the queue. I don't know how many or how many are left or what size. Those that have not asked, we did send notices to those folks that we were holding them. And as soon as the board acts to lift the moratorium as to the processing of those applications, then work can recommence. One of the hypotheticals that I gave you earlier about beginning to process those applications that are currently on hold. But indeed, the board's moratorium did stop the acceptance of new applications, stop the processing of existing applications, and new service connections until the moratorium was lifted and the rate was established. So I would also say that as to any applications that were received, processed, and connected prior to the moratorium, the second one, those have been operating. They were fully processed, and they continue to be operating today.
Question for Roberto, I guess, or I want to keep you involved. So I'm just trying to think how this works. So you paid $3,000 as part of your application fee. Was it specifically
for the feasibility study? I think it is
for the study. So, so then after the moratorium is dropped, and if you're still on board and want to proceed, there may be additional charges. As we all have heard, for transmission, distribution, whatever. But this, so the $3,000, can that apply toward the additional charges?
No, that's just basically the application fee.
That's just the upfront application.
Yeah. But my question is, all the new rates are applying towards, or I mean, are being based on requests or applications that some other big companies came in and put in. And I'm assuming many of these new applications never came through. The new rates are going to be set in there, assuming they failed off, you know?
That's a fair question, but Lindsay could probably answer that, right? Or speak to it.
I'd like to comment first on the $3,000 application fee question that you had, Commissioner Congdon. Those application fees are paid at the time of application to cover engineering time and resources associated with designing the job, but the $3,000 is actually credited towards any work that the customer needs done by the PUD associated with their connection. So they don't just disappear. They are credited back to the customer.
Okay. Okay.
And if I'm not mistaken, Roberto, you're mining now. Isn't that correct?
Yes.
Yes. All right.
Yes, I have one location. It's a small 68 kilowatt. Sure. Under the papers has been running. Right.
But you're wanting to expand?
Yeah.
Okay. I just want a clarification.
Well, and then situations happen, like I'm in the middle of one small operation that a guy that is out of the state came on and say, hey, Roberto, let's make an agreement. I don't want to be dealing with PUD whenever this rate came through. So let's do this. Let's make a agreement, and you get my hardware, keep on mining, and keep on moving. Because I'm on the moratorium, that location has been disconnected, even though I purchased the hardware, just because I'm on the moratorium. So I pay a bunch of money, and PUD just said, hey, I cannot change your name, so I have to shoot down this location.
Okay.
So kind of weird situation.
Thank you.
So, Lindsay, can someone get back to him with a some sort of a response to his second question about the large number of requests, some of the really large requests that may have dropped off at that, if that's going to impact.
So Commissioner, we
have not officially had any large customers pull their applications.
So that answers his question then.
Right, and we can't share customer information about who and who's asked for how much, et cetera, et cetera, unless they agree to it.
But the answer is none.
Right.
Thank you.
Lindsay, also, it seems like a part of that answer, and you would be better versed than I, that the charges that we were talking about basing was not based on the volume, was based on the cost of serving the customer that was making the application. And so if customers did drop off, that wouldn't change the cost of the service, would it?
It was a combination. So it is based on the cost of service, but because of the volume of requests that we had, we do have that situation with our energy portfolio, where because of the volume, the large request that we were receiving, that was the driver for the energy rate associated with this class being tied with the market.
Okay, yeah. Okay. Thank you. There's no public comment?
Hi there. Thomas O'Connell, 12049 Brett's Drive, Leavenworth. Residential crypto miner. I've spoken at the last couple of meetings. And, you know, the current rate structure proposal, depending on the direction that the market takes over the next 6 months to 12 months, you know, it could possibly work. How it's been happening over the last 6 to 8 months, we're out of business. And we don't really see a turnaround anytime soon, realistically. So, that's a lot of full-time jobs that are currently in existence in Chelan County. That's a lot of money that people are dumping all those earnings back into the county. And then, you know, I see talk of this, the diamond foundry or this artificial diamond production facility going in. You know, I've seen the transformers going in down there. My questions are, you know, are they going to be paying an increased rate? From my understanding, they're operating 24/7. They're drawing more power than pretty much all of us residential crypto miners combined, to my knowledge. Are they going to be, you know, paying an increased rate? Are they obligated for that? Or are we just being singled out? You know, those are potential jobs that don't exist yet. These are jobs that exist now. So just something to consider. You know, most of us or a lot of us have been born in this county. A lot of us have lived here for, you know, half decade more. Sometimes some even longer than that. You know, I'm 25 years in this county, originally born here. I don't want to have to leave. I don't want to have to move my business. I'd like to continue to put that money I earn back into the county, but it doesn't seem like I'm going to be able to. So I'm prepared to move everything. I think everyone's been making preparations, but at the end of the day, we don't want to. This is my home. This is where I'd like to stay. You know, parties that were approved under the initial rates from last year. You know, we were approved under that. Our loads are calculated for in the current demand. Why can we not be grandfathered in at that rate? You guys can change the new customers. You know, that doesn't really affect us. But the existing loads, the people that are operating out of their houses that don't have room to expand, you know, we're out of it then at that point. And like I said, that's a lot of jobs. So thank you.
Thank you.
Jean Poyer, Cashmere, Washington. Never quite sure what I'm going to say at these meetings, but I've been to every single one since May because I feel that this issue is critical to where we live. And it also, I believe, has a great effect on climate change, which is why I keep coming to these things. I certainly appreciate our general manager describing himself as a pragmatic businessman. I have a little argument with him. Sometimes I feel our PUD is short-sighted on not having more renewables, though I was corrected. We have 20% of the wind farm in the southeast corner of our state. To me, that's still not solar panels on our fruit warehouses. Climate change is happening. We see it happening in our world. It's just barely beginning. And so my concern as someone that cares for the earth and looks at our PUD as you're not only just the stewards of our infrastructure with this community.
Jean, can I interrupt impact. You?
Yes.
Gentlemen, people are respectful of you and listen to you. I expect the same thing from you. So please keep your comments. This is a meeting where we're listening to one another, and I would ask that you be respectful of people that are up here listening, that are speaking. Fair enough? Thank you. I'm speaking to the two of you. I'm asking you to be quiet while someone's speaking. Thank you. Go ahead, Jean.
Thank you. So I appreciate that. I mean, the PUD's in a hard position here. you're not only just stewards of our infrastructure, but you're also in charge of the water. You're in charge of the health of our rivers. I feel that you have bent over backwards on this issue of Bitcoin. And I was so proud that our general manager did go back and speak to the U.S. Senate committee just at the end of August on cryptocurrency. So the world is watching us here on these decisions and how we deal with it. His first comment I especially liked is cryptocurrency's value worth the infrastructure upgrades and the environmental costs that come with it. So speaking to this issue from strictly a climate change point of view, the numbers of the carbon emissions are going up. There have been global concerns about that. And on an individual carbon budget, if we don't want to see that temperature go above 1.5 degrees Celsius, then we need to try and have our carbon budget be individually at 5 tons a year or less. Already in Chelan County, an average home uses 1,000 tons a month. That's 19 tons of carbon from clean renewable energy going out to the atmosphere. So you take a look at the Bitcoin miners, their average kilowatt monthly, this is the average home operator, backyard operator, is 19,440 kilowatts a month. That's 190 tons of carbon going out in emissions. So I bring up the point as stewards of the land, of the health, of our infrastructure, to not lose sight of the impact that cryptocurrency has on our global emissions of carbon to this degree, and that I know from the PUD's resources that we can reduce fossil fuel power generation by the carbon outputs by reducing our use of renewable energy. So I think that's about all I have to say on the matter.
Thank you, Jean.
I just have something for Jean.
Yeah.
Is it Jean or Jeannie? Jean? Either one. I just wanted to correct something so that it's not incorrect in the record. We don't own 20% of the Nine Canyon Wind Farm. We're participants in about 8.6%.
Okay, I got that.
And I just didn't want to go out. I know you got it from somebody, but I didn't want it to go out because that's a fair difference. That's a big difference.
So it's only 8.6%?
It's 8%. There's three phases, and at one time we were 12%, but then when they engaged in the third phase and we didn't take part in that third phase, then that put us at about 8.6%.
Correct.
Okay, then that's even a lot less.
Yes. Thank you. Additional comment?
Commissioners, while you're waiting for the next comment to come forward, I would like to correct myself. Been notified that I was wrong. On our large customers, we did have one applicant reduce their request or pull their request of the over 5 megawatt loads, but it would not be significant enough to change our rate plans. So.
Okay. Any other public comment?
Philip Harrison, 214 2nd Street in Wenatchee, Washington. I had a Schedule 35 service that was discontinued up the INIAT. It was a building, I was just trying to utilize the power that was in that building for an obsolete building. That power was going to be used at some point in time. Andy told me to come in and put an application in because I had bought and installed the service for that, but there was a little bit of a dispute with the tenant, and he came down and changed the service in his name. So that with the moratorium on, Andy said, come down, fill out an application. So I did. I had no idea that they were going to pull the service, turn the service off. Well, that's typically what happened about a week ago. line, and I paid for the service, and they wouldn't let me turn the, you know, the power back on.
So you're looking for an answer from the commission?
Yeah.
Okay, for policy, that would be operational, so I would hope that someone qualified in the, as our staff member would be able to answer that. Andy, are you available? Or?
Well, I'll.
Or Lindsay, I'm sorry,
yeah,
Lindsay.
No, that's okay.
Yeah.
So just to start off with, any change in the name on a service requires an application. So that's the driver for that. And we are on the board's moratorium for accepting applications for cryptocurrency load. So that is the purpose behind that. And the district does have a hearing process available where we can listen to a customer if a hearing is requested and consider all of the facts of the situation. And if Andy wants to add to that, he's welcome.
Yeah, I think you, Lindsay, covered it. What's important here is that, you know, while we appreciate having the opportunity during the moratorium to think about our rates and policies and our, you know, our look forward to the impacts of the cryptocurrencies, we also work hard to try to maintain consistency in how we're treating our customers. In this particular instance, the customer who occupied the building that the account was under, the customer contacted us to discontinue service, and we did so. We were denying any other cryptocurrency miners to occupy that, consistent with how we've applied our policies throughout the moratorium. Of course, that could change if that's something that the board wishes, but we were applying policy consistent with how we have. The service in this particular case was disconnected because at the current moment, we don't have a paying customer. So it's our policy that if the service is not reestablished in another name, that we discontinue that service until such time application is made. We have agreed to allow the service to go back into a general service, a non-crypto status, and that is consistent with our policies as well.
Thank you. Does that help?
We put an application in for a tenant, so we do have somebody that wants the service.
All right.
And I was willing to put that in my name. I came in and filled out the application. I asked for the last 3 years' power use. They gave me the first 2.5 years, which was in my name. And they said, well, we can't give you the use the last 6 or 7 months. So I go out to my car, get on the phone with customer service, and they send that information to me. So I had that. I had that power use. But that's how I was being treated downstairs. And I also was using this building for my orchard operation, and I had tractors and farm equipment that I was trying to utilize during the harvest, and they wouldn't come down and turn that service on for me. I told them I would turn all the breakers off for any cryptocurrency that could be used, but they said they couldn't do that.
Okay. Thank you. I think let me finish. I think you made contact with other, you know, commissioners. I think your particular case is being heard and considered, and I think there may be some options presented if I've read the emails correctly. And Steve,
I was just, you know, maybe this is out of the realm of the hearing today, and would just encourage filing for a hearing and pleading those particular issues in front of the hearing officer and see what the PUD can do for you. That would be my encouragement.
Yeah, unfortunately, I had a contract. I had no idea that they would shut this thing down.
Right.
I had a contract with the new person to go ahead with the power use.
Mm-hmm.
Now I'm going to lose that. So, how soon can these hearings be convened?
I don't know.
I think we spoke this morning that we can arrange for a hearing as early as this Thursday, if you're available, and we can speak after the meeting to schedule that.
So, commissioners, I would just say that it would be consistent with the board's
adopted moratorium resolution that when one existing crypto operation shuts down, we would not hook up another cryptocurrency operation, even in the same space, under a new customer name, hard stop, period, until there is some action on the moratorium. Because that would be, it would be inconsistent with the board's adopted moratorium resolution.
Philip, I'm going to ask you to hold. And if someone else needs to speak, we'll let them. And then you can have a second bite of the apple. Could you please honor? Thank you. Anyone else? Feeling a little foolish, Phil? But thank you for being respectful. I do appreciate that.
No problem. But like I was saying, that service was in my name, and I told the tenant to pay the bill. I just assumed he changed the billing address. I didn't know he actually turned
Correct.
The service into his name.
Yeah.
I have had that in my name since the beginning.
Yeah.
So I should have continued then with my next thought, commissioners, which is, that's exactly the kind of information that could be considered by a hearings examiner and decisions can be made, that it is or is not consistent given any particular set of circumstances with the board's moratorium or not. So I don't know those facts. I apologize. I just got back today. The treatment of one customer to the next that's been described would be consistent with the moratorium if indeed there was some nefarious changing of the customer names or, you know, mistake there, then that should be brought before the hearings examiner, and the hearings examiner can provide some decisions on this.
Yeah. And Philip, I want you to understand that commission does care about you as a customer and what happens to you. And it sounds like there's kind of lots of loose ends, maybe in multiple directions, and we should be able to maybe get those tied up Thursday for you. So, again, thank you for bringing it forward. In my opinion, that concludes the public input portion of our hearing. Lindsay, thank you very much.
Okay. Thank you.
And we didn't attempt to supersede Andy over
That's okay.
your position at the table. He was just looking painful.
Yeah. He's anxious.
That's just how Andy looks.
Well, okay.
Dennis, we do have a couple motions.
We do have two proposed motions
right.
On the table.
Yeah, so. It just concludes the public input portion.
Okay.
Right, so commissioners, we would need to set a next hearing date, and your first proposed motion would accomplish that task and set it for November 19 during the board's regular meeting. And then the second proposed motion is to, consistent with the board's recently adopted new rate making resolution, this is the one that you heard from Kathy on not too many meetings ago. Staff has proposed the plan. I think it's actually set out on the page with all the cool logos on it. And so this motion would, if it meets with the board's expectations and satisfaction, set out the outreach plan that would go forward in advance of the rate hearing. It would also set the rate hearing for the November 19th date.
So can we do these two motions together? Or would you prefer to do them separately?
You may do them together with an and between them.
Is the board ready
Comment.
For a motion?
Thank you. Okay, Mr. Chairman, I propose that in order to allow time for staff to implement, I propose this motion. In order to allow time for staff to implement board direction provided today, I move to continue the moratorium and set the next public hearing for November 19, 2018, during the board's regular meeting. And I move to set the rate outreach plan, number and location of informational meetings, and date of public rate hearing as proposed by staff in the presentation.
Second.
It's been moved and seconded to take two promotions. Two motions can combine those to continue the moratorium and set the next public hearing date from November 19, 2018, during the board's regular session and set the rate outreach plan, number, and location of informational meetings and data public hearing as proposed by staff in the presentation. Is there a further discussion?
We have Commissioner Arsenal outside.
We're going to move on.
Okay.
If there's no further discussion, those in favor of the motion as presented, signify by saying aye.
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 Those opposed, say no. Motion is carried.
Thank you, Commissioner.
Thank you.
Thanks, Lindsay.
Thanks, Lindsay.
Well, that moves us to the consent agenda.
I would move approval of the consent agenda.
Is there a second?
Second.
It's been moved and seconded to approve the consent agenda as presented. Any discussion? Hearing none, we will move to item 8 from the morning's agenda, strategic facilities plan.
We need to vote.
Well, you know, that's a really important piece to bring up. You think I'm anxious to get this thing back on track? Those in favor of the motion to accept the consent agenda as presented, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Thank you. Good catch. I appreciate it. Okay. Now we're ready.
We are.
Yeah.
So I'd like to welcome Dan Frazier to come back to update us on one of the contracts related to the strategic facilities plan. And he'll be previewing this for board approval on June 1, the next meeting.
So we hope. Thank you, Dan Frazier, again, Director of Shared Services. As part of the overall land transaction and that we've been working on with the port for several months, we decided that each of these, as they came forward, would have a presentation. Almost all of the agreements, I should say, are going to be packaged into hopefully one or two presentations. But this one was a little more time sensitive, so we're coming to you a little earlier with this individual building lease. And this is the building on the far left side of the screen there, the IB5 building, also known as the JanSport building, most recently the Fibro building. So what I'd like to walk through a little bit of today is, again, no action requested. This is just a presentation. Go through really quickly the lease terms. Some of them were in the term sheet that the port and the PUD enacted a few months ago. I'll talk a little bit about the planned use of the building, update on the progress of the other documents that represent the 9 total agreements that we're working on to perfect this deal. So as you recall, these are all the properties that are involved in the transaction. So today we're talking about the yellow building there, the yellow outline section. The red is the property, and, of course, the green is the CTC, which is a part of this agreement. So the major elements of the agreement, the PUD will lease the 26,000 square feet, which is that easternmost part of the building. It's a combination of office and warehouse space. The initial term of the lease is 4 years with 2 one-year PUD options for renewal. The lease rate is 65 cents per square foot, which is basically a commercial rate. And there are some additional costs for reimbursement of shared items like fire systems, landscaping. Those equate to around 5 to 6 cents per square foot. Some other important provisions of this agreement is it's tied to the other agreements, the other 8 agreements, such that if the sale of the land and the CTC condo units does not go through, or if the PUD elects not to develop after we did purchase the property, we can get out of this lease, or the port can ask us to get out of the lease. But we have put a 180-day provision in there, and only because we feel like once we move in, it would take us a while to find another space and move out. So we do have a 6-month termination provision. That's an option to terminate. It's not required, but that's just something we put in there in case we were not going to exercise our options to move out in that location. So what was the plan of using the building? Well, we had some priorities. One was to relieve the pent-up demand for additional space. We haven't made any major investments in expansion of facilities since the CTC was built in 2004 timeframe. Everything else has been just remodels or little minor updates. So we have some pent-up demand in space. We wanted to relocate groups that are currently leasing facilities in other areas. We have some leased buildings on our sites. We have people that are leasing space off-site. So those groups would be high priority. We want to relocate materials in our facilities that need work. We have some water materials that are in a building that needs work like today if we weren't going to be there. And so we can basically recapture that cost of a repair that we are not going to do because we'll move those materials into this building and just tear down those other buildings. And we'll also provide space for operations and service center project management team. So if we do go forward with development of the operations and service center headquarters, we would locate the team in that building. It's right across the street from the property. Great place to manage and not have to lease a bunch of trailers to run that project. So the potential occupants that came forward as we put out the request for who's interested and who needs space, Fiber Telecom business unit was one of the first that came to mind. They're a good-sized group, but they're a group that would fit in this facility. They're one of the ones that deploy broadly throughout the county, and so this new point, as we found in our initial feasibility, this is a great point to deploy from, and so to have that group deploying at that point is a good strategy to see how that works. And their warehousing needs aren't great. If we were to move somebody like distribution out there where we needed a whole bunch of warehousing, that wouldn't work. So they have a reasonable amount of warehousing. Distribution Meter Shop, AMI, is another group. That's actually going to relieve the pressures in the Holly Street facility if we move them out. So the expansion of the Holly Street facility we've been just cramming more and more people into a smaller space, they can move out into the space that's vacated by the meter shop. Our lands maintenance crew, which is in a leased building right now, asset management team that is growing, and they're in various areas, but they cram a bunch of people into a little conference room down here is one of their locations, and so getting them a little more space would be good. And again, as I said, the engineering project management facilities development team is identified there. So there are 9 documents for us to execute to get through this entire term sheet. The access agreement was approved August 1st. The lease of the IB5 building is presented today, and our plan is to be back October 1st. We're down to the last little I's and T's to dot and cross at this point, so by 2 Mondays from now, we should have everything ready to present to the board. The remaining documents that are undergoing development and review, we have 2 purchase and sale agreements. We have the lease back of the facility that we would be selling, the condo units, to the port. We'd lease those back. We have the use agreement for the video conference center, which is that 9-year lease that we've talked about. A capacity reservation agreement for the CTC to ensure that the building can still be used for its current use as a data center. Then the last 2 are the options for the port to purchase back the land from the PUD should we not develop. And the other option is for the port to purchase a portion or all of the 5th Street or Holly Street parcels as we move toward a redevelopment option. So the port has a first option to come in and say that I think that's something we can work with, and then they can move forward with it. So those are all the agreements that we're going through right now. They're very far down the road. We've done a lot of work on them. Karen Wiggum and Vicki Griffin and I have been working a lot on this. This is our number 1 priority right now. And so we're trying to get these. Our goal is to have these executed before the end of the year. And so we would probably bring these back. Our goal is to bring them back one time, all of the agreements, one presentation, and then one action later. That may not be the case. A couple of these are just a little more complicated. And so they're going to take a little more time. So anyway, that's where we're at. Any questions?
Steve McKenna.
Dan, so before the lease of the building, we would actually have access to it and use it. All 9 of those agreements have to be taken.
No, this is a standalone agreement. It is tied back. So this agreement would be, our plan is to execute it October 1st. We would have access to the building October 1st.
Oh, okay.
And if we were not able to close the other agreements, then we could get out.
I gotcha. Yeah. But if we wanted to, we can use the building. Thank you, Dennis.
All right. Dan, very much. Thank you. Rock Island Powerhouse 2, rehab, item 9.
John Sagerser is going to be providing some information on the alternative contracting method we're pursuing. And this item will also be coming back in 2 weeks.
going to be a busy October 1st for you guys.
It is.
So thanks for having me. Again, I'm John Segerser, engineering manager at Rock Island, and also the project manager for the Powerhouse 2 rehabilitation project. As Lorna mentioned, we wanted to give you an update on the design build procurement methodology. We were here talking with you in July, giving you an update that we were planning on using this alternative procurement method, so we want to let you know how that was going. I also wanted to give you an update on the contractor selection process using that new method, as well as the next steps. So again, we are not looking for action today, but we'll be looking for action at the next meeting on October 1st. Today, we would like a show of your continued support for the design build method. So as I mentioned, we last updated you in July, where we informed you of our intent to use the design build method. We also presented some of the results from the request for information. As you recall, we sent out a request for information to all the turbine and generator manufacturers, giving them an opportunity to look at our project, provide input on our scope, our schedule, things along those lines. Since we have submitted our application to the State Project Review Committee, they're the state board that authorizes use of the alternative procurement methods, and we are scheduled to present to them on September 27th. We have developed the request for qualifications. That's the first step in the design build process, where we would select two contractors based on their qualifications, and we hope to have that advertised in early October and no later than October 31st. We're also developing the criteria whereby we would select those two most qualified contractors and inviting them into a design process with us, as well as finalizing the technical specifications that we'd use for the overall project. As you recall, during the request for information process, one of the things that we heard consistently from the manufacturers was that they recommended all new generators, particularly if we wanted to do anything different with how they're currently set up as far as noise, access, cooling, anything along those lines. We would need to replace the stators as well as the rotors. So we've updated our economic models to include those potential increases in scope as well as their associated cost. And we've also developed a model that would help us determine what the total cost of ownership for some of these different design options that we're expecting to see as a part of this process. So we could look at them side by side and at least have an idea of what could be the least cost for the district over a 40-year. So under design build, the contractor selection process, quite a bit different than our normal design bid build process, would look something like this. So we would develop this request for qualifications. We would issue that to the public, essentially a broad range of contractors, anybody who's interested. We would use the responses from the request for qualifications to select two contractors. We would invite those two contractors that we deem to be the most qualified to perform this work in Powerhouse 2 to we would issue them a request for proposal and invite them to participate in a competitive design process whereby they would go through and they would do we're expecting closer to 30% design level for the refurbishment of the turbines and generators at Rock Island. Part of their submittal would be what they call cost factors. So it's really kind of an estimated cost of what they think it could be. Based on those results, we would evaluate what we think is best for us, with, again, the cost factors being just that one of the factors that we would use to select the contractor. And we would select what we think is the best design and the best contractor for us. At that point in time, we actually negotiate a contract with them for the remaining of the design process. So they would go through and finish their design from the 30% on up to about 90%. And that can range anywhere from 60 to 70% design all the way up to 90% design. And at that point in time, they're far enough into the design process. They have a better idea of how much it's going to cost when we actually go in and take apart a unit, what it's going to cost for manufacturing of new parts. And so we would enter into negotiations again to negotiate what is the price for the first unit, as well as what is the cost for all 8 units. And then we would complete that in about the fourth quarter of 2019, somewhere around in there, when we would expect that we would actually have a contract price that's negotiated with the contractor for the first unit as well as all 8 units. Okay?
Question.
Yes, sir.
I make the assumption in this process that probably in this plethora of projects that we've got going, we're going to have some activities that we want our people to perform. How does that fit into a contractor-driven model? Is that specified? Is that in the specs part?
It is.
Okay.
Yep. So not any different than what we do now at the end of the process. You know, by the time we negotiate, we still end up with a contract document that clearly defines their boundaries, their scope of work. They do this, we do this. What do they provide? What do we provide? Okay. So we still have that kind of defining document in all the volumes of technical specifications, what they should do, what they need to meet, guarantees, warranties, incentives, bonding, insurance, all that stuff is still described out in the contract.
Okay.
Okay.
Thank you.
Yeah.
In terms of trying to understand how this process works, is there then, once we make an award and the price has been agreed to, is there an adjustment possible for cost overruns at that time? And second part of that question is, you mentioned that once the first turbine and generator was complete, it would then be a bid process for the next 8. Is that a bundled bid? And once again, is there any cost overruns that are able to be charged against that?
Yeah, absolutely. So the design build method really more defines how you select the contractor. Once we execute the contract, it's a contract just like every other contract that we have. So there's possibilities for cost overruns. There's possibilities for amendments and adjustments to the agreement just like there was before. So once we negotiate the contract, if the scope changes, we tear into one unit and, you know, we can't reuse the turbine, we've got to build a new one. That would be a change in scope. We'd have to issue an amendment to the contract, add that. Same if whatever, we didn't need some other part, and we could issue an amendment to reduce the contract as well.
So maybe the third part of that question. Does bidding in this manner change the warranty on the work done in any way?
The only reason that it would change that is in a traditional design, bid, build procurement process, we would typically designate a warranty that we were seeking, hopefully an educated designation based upon feedback, etc. This gives us a little more ability to negotiate that term with the contractor. I think the hope is we would get a better warranty, longer warranty, right, than our typical design, bid, build. The simple answer, though, Commissioner, is all of those provisions will be addressed in the contract before it is executed. So unless staff and the decision team, which includes the senior management and the board, in the approval of the contract, unless we're satisfied, we simply won't execute the contract. And I don't think that this particular procurement methodology increases or necessarily decreases the likelihood that there was risk on both sides, contractor and district, for potential changes, potential claims, unknowns, those kinds of things. It is, as John suggested, simply a procurement methodology. That said, we're always mindful of those provisions, and we draft for them in the contract to make sure we understand how those risks and responsibilities are allocated before we execute them. And I think that the hope is, and I know you've heard Steve say it, and you've heard John and his team say it previously, that this methodology is a more cooperative, in some respects, opportunity for the district to get a product that meets its expectations and allows a contractor to help us shape the design and delivery of what ultimately we'll be buying in an effort to get a better end result in terms of equipment, operation, warranty provisions than we would with a design bid build, where your weakness in that process, candidly, is always you're driven by the low dollar. And it's always based, as you know, because we have to reject bidders from time to time, on the document we put out there. There's not any real give and take or contractor input short of prior to the process starting. So all of those risks exist, but we draft for them.
The change order process, is this designed to help reduce that? I probably can't eliminate it based upon what you might find as you dig into things.
Yeah, that's one of the major things that it should help us with, because, again, as you're collaborative with the contractor in developing what the terms and conditions of the contract are, the technical specifications are, we don't end up, you know, specifying something that they can't really provide, and eliminating some of those types of change orders and variances that we would see normally.
I think of it often as their opportunity to help us build a better mousetrap. Mm-hmm. We often ask for mousetraps, and they'll build us whatever we ask for typically, but sometimes if we ask them, and this provides an opportunity to ask them, they can provide input that results in a better outcome.
Questions?
Very good.
So just an important note, what we're talking about right now really is for the turbines and the generators within Powerhouse 2. Part of the work at Powerhouse 2 includes the bridge and gantry crane upgrades, a lot of the balance of plant systems that we have, such as the motor control centers, service water systems, some of these other types of things that also may need contracts. Some of them we're thinking might be suited for one of these alternative methods, as such as design build, or similar to the facilities that we use, the general contractor construction manager, or GCCM method. And so I just wanted to make you aware that this is specific for the governor and or the turbine generator units, and you may see other contracts and other requests for qualifications associated with the other balance of plant equipment later this year. Okay. So again, we're kind of looking for your show of support for the design build method as we approach the state on the 27th. That is a question that they'll ask us. Does your board know that you're here, and are they supportive of you? We'd like to be able to say yes. We're going to finish developing the request for proposal and the selection criteria, how we're going to determine which design and which contractor is best for the district. And of course, we'll be back in 2 weeks with a resolution requesting to advertise the request for qualifications. Other questions?
John, thank you.
You're welcome.
Nice job. Appreciate it.
Go forth and do good work.
All right.
Yeah.
Well,
thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you, John. And now Bruce Porter will tell us a little bit about the resolution approving a new interlocal cooperative purchasing agreement.
So yes. Can we? I'm sorry. Let's do the consent agenda first.
Okay.
We got.
We did.
Oh, you did?
We did.
Well, I was sleeping apparently.
Thank you.
Well, I was didn't call for a vote.
I must have stepped out. You didn't call for a vote on the consent agenda?
No. So I was reminded, and we voted on it.
Then, Lorna, you have my sincere apologies.
Duly noted.
Good afternoon. Bruce Porter, Procurement Contract Services. This resolution is to authorize the district to enter into an intergovernmental cooperative purchasing agreement with the University of Washington for the benefit of utilization of contracts for the purchase of supplies, materials, equipment, and/or services as appropriate. This agreement will remain in effect until termination by either party. There are no fees that will be charged to either of us during the term of this contract. A current example of a contract that we may access would be the University of Washington has an agreement with a local furniture distributor for the design, purchase, and installation of steelcase furniture, which is one of the lines of furniture that we currently acquire here at the district. All contracts will be competitively solicited and advertised nationally for the minimum number of days required by statute, and each solicitation will contain language that allows the contract to be used by the participants. The interlocal cooperative purchasing agreement has been reviewed by legal and by PCS. As per resolution, the commission approval is required for the master purchasing agreement only. I recommend that the district enter into the intergovernmental cooperative purchasing agreement for the benefit of making UW contracts available to the district. PCS will continue to work with our internal customers to determine when use of cooperative purchasing agreements is in the district's best interest, taking into consideration convenience, price, as well as local suppliers. Any questions?
Do we have questions of Bruce?
Just one comment. The only thing that could maybe make this a little better is if it was with WSU.
I would think. You know.
Legal would have denied that one.
And since I'm a cougar, I will go out and look.
There you go. All right. Bruce, thank you very much.
Thanks, Bruce. Thank you.
Resolution 18, please.
Bruce, you may have to check with Gonzaga, too.
Okay. We'll do that as well. Resolution 18.
So I have Ian Adams to talk to us about the resolution authorizing the general manager or his designee to enter into a funding agreement with the Confederated Tribes and Bands of the Yakima Nation for Coho Hatchery compensation related to the Rocky Reach and Rock Island hydroelectric projects. Welcome, and Aline is with us as well.
Thanks, Lorna. Good afternoon, Commissioners. If you recall, 2 weeks ago we came to you and presented the details of an agreement with the Yakima Nation, and we committed to returning you today to request authorization to approve that agreement, and so Ian's going to walk over those details now.
Good afternoon, Commissioners. Today we're here to ask for your authorization to enter into a funding agreement with the Yakima Nation for a Coho program. This will be a 15-year not-to-exceed agreement with them. It would take us through 2032. And the terms of this agreement will help us achieve our HCP obligation for our Coho mitigation of hatchery Coho our Coho hatchery mitigation. There's an annual payment on this. The annual average payment is $646,221 with a, as I said, 15-year not to exceed, and the total of that not to exceed is $9,694,000. We've done quite a bit of homework on this. We have looked at a number of different alternatives, and we believe that this is the most cost-effective and efficient alternative for the district to move forward with. And for a number of reasons, the pilot program that we entered into an agreement with the Yakima Nation back in 2007 has been and was very successful for us in helping the district achieve its HCP hatchery mitigation for Coho. And this agreement gives us future certainty for the next 15 years. And all the other alternatives that we looked at were not nearly as efficient and as effective as this program will be for the district. Is there any other questions?
Commissioner Congdon.
Did you say $9 million or $19
million? I said $9 million. $9
million. $9 million.
Yep. Wow. $694,000.
Yeah. I'd be interested in the number, the total number of what it costs us to, however, whether it's through the Hatchery Committee or tributary or whatever, what the cost is to achieve no net.
No net impact.
Thank you. I couldn't think of impact. Because this is just Coho, and we've got Sockeye. We've got Sockeye, and we've got all the other parts to this. And then that would be, I think we've done it before, but I think that would be a great number to publicize and get out there. I wish Jeannie Poirier were here and she could hear what we are spending on saving fish, achieving this no net impact at our projects.
Yeah, we can certainly report back on that.
Yeah, I bet you've got it, you know.
I don't have that off the top of my head, but yeah.
Right, yeah, no, that's cool.
Other comments? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Commissioners, we can either do these together, 17 and 18, or we can do them independent. Up to you. Let me know what you wish.
I would move approval of Resolution 17 and 18.
I would second.
And moved and seconded to accept Resolution 17 and 18 as presented. Is there further discussion? Hearing none, I will call for the vote. Those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed, no. Motion is carried. Manager items, 19.
So we have two manager items today. The first is early action infrastructure, and Tracy Hunt will come up and talk to us more about this exciting development.
Walking slow because he wants somebody else in the room with him.
that's a good news story.
So then I guess we are for Suzanne Grizel to join us. Would you like to have Janet Jaspers go first?
Yeah,
Janet, okay.
Janet, it did not take you long to throw you right under.
Tell us more about the extension of the Mid-Sea Coordination Agreement.
Okay, good afternoon. And my name is Janet Jaspers, Energy Planning and Trading Manager. And we have had an agreement called Mid-Columbia Hourly Coordination since about the mid-1970s. In 1997, we had a 30-year agreement, and so that one expired in June 2017. At that time, Douglas, our PUD, said we want to operate independently. So Grant and Schlan said, we would like some time to do some modeling and see what we can come up with a successor agreement. And so we had a bridge agreement at that time. And so in 2017, it was looking like we didn't quite agree on how to coordinate together, so we decided to each independently operate. And now it looks like everyone is not going to kind of finish their work. And so Grant had kind of come to us and said, we would like an extension. And so we thought it was mutually beneficial. And so we have a letter agreement dated August 24th, and so we extended the kind of termination of that from June 30th, 2019 to November 30th, 2019, so an extra 5 months. And so our project team, our two-dam independent project team, is taking a look at that extra time and looking at it to see what we can do. We have started talking with some of our internal stakeholders, saying, do we have folks who are kind of overloaded or have some other high priority work that we can do in time? A couple of things, more documentation or enhanced documentation is certainly an option, how to fill that time. And also extra training in system operations. I think we have extended offers to three and planning on extending an offer to a fourth person. And so it's just some extra time to do extra training with them too. So looks like we'll be cutting over to independent operations sometime late October. And then this extension agreement actually has a term of November 30th, 2019.
questions?
So the extension is with Grant, not Douglas?
Uh-huh. Douglas decided to go their separate way June 2017.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. Thank you. Now, Tracy.
Okay.
All right.
I feel like I'm ready.
So, Tracy Hunt, Director of External Affairs, and Suzanne Grissel, Manager of Government Affairs, Federal Government Affairs. So, last time we were here, we gave a little update, like on sea lions, as a step in the right direction. Today, we have some really good news that I wouldn't have been appropriate for me to start without Suzanne being in the room. So, I want to give a little background, and then Suzanne's going to do the punchline, and then I'll do some wrap up. So about 5 years ago, and I thought it was more like 2 years ago, and then Suzanne said, no, we've been working on this for 5 years. We were talking about a problem that we had with what we thought was a problem with FERC, where they basically assign license durations based on how much money you spend during the next license. And maybe that's okay for some, but for us, at the end of the Rock Island license, where here we are spending upwards of $500 million, that we didn't get credit for to set the current license duration, we saw that as maybe not good public policy. So that $500 million wouldn't have counted if we went into this next licensing process. It basically, the FERC policy created a disincentive to invest early. Could be on environmental, could be recreation, could be major maintenance, whatever. But, you know, you're basically a licensee sitting there going, I'm going to hold off till I can get credit for this. Makes sense. So we sat there and, like I said, it was 5 years ago, came up with an idea that hopefully would incent licensees to invest during the current license rather than waiting. And we called that idea credit for early action. So over the last 5 years, we've made several attempts. We've made some progress. In fact, I think we were in here several months, if not a year ago, talking about FERC changing their 30-year license baseline to a 40-year license. That was largely from the work that we and others were working on with our associations, but it was a step in the right direction, but it didn't go all the way to what we were working towards. We tried this legislation or some verbiage, some similar language showed up in energy legislation or hydro bills, but those, again, went nowhere. And then last Monday, well, actually Sunday night, the phone rang. And?
Well, yes, I got this basically text saying now they're looking at potentially adding provisions of hydro licensing to basically what's the Water Resources Development Act, this figure they're calling it, the America's Water Infrastructure Act. This is legislation that for the past 6 years, I guess they've been getting it updated every couple of years. It's becoming kind of regular order again. And it's one of those kind of must-have pieces of legislation, and we had been told it wasn't going to be a vehicle for hydro. Comes out of a different committee, comes out of a transportation committee in the House and Environment and Public Works in the Senate. So get this text. Licensing is moving, and there's confusion about the language, and, you know, text us, call us. You know, we want some advice. And so it was a very busy, exciting day. And at the end of the day, we have very good language and the legislation that we're really excited about. It basically requires that FERC give equal weight to the value of early action investments that have not already been considered in establishing the length of the license term. So if it hasn't been considered, you get equal weight for that investment as you would if you had proposed it as part of the license package. They also added some examples of the type of investments that FERC should need to consider, including redevelopment, modernization, rehabilitation, or replacement of major equipment, which was the big one for us, safety issues, environmental, recreation, and other issues. So we're very pleased with that language. Also, there is a provision that we were supporting that would actually direct the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission to give us an answer within 60 days of us asking a confirmation of whether a proposed early action would qualify for the policy. It's not committing the commission to a specific number of years, but it is kind of a thumbs up, thumbs down on whether we think something would qualify, and that would give certainty to licensing. So we're excited about that.
Suzanne, sorry to interrupt, but so there's no time limit. It just depends on. I mean, there's no. You can only go back 5 years, or
that's not expressly in the legislation.
The criteria was that it's not an investment that you already got credit for in the license. So there are some next steps, figuring out all the rules and everything that's not defined in the current legislation.
Right.
But it doesn't say you can look back 5 years or 10 years. Right now, it's just you didn't already get credit for it.
Okay.
Did you want to talk about the next steps, or do you want me to?
You want the status?
Mm-hmm. Status. Okay, I almost missed this part. So Monday, the legislation, I mean, between getting the call, basically, and it was one day. The legislation passed on Monday, so that was an exciting day. And then our understanding is that it's going to pass the Senate this week, or at least by the end of this month, and is expected to be signed by the president. We do have copies of some press releases from Senator Cantwell and Representative Kathy McMorris Rogers. The great thing about this legislation and this provision in particular is definitely a bipartisan, has always had really good support from both sides of the aisle, and both of our supporters are basically endorsing it and claiming credit for helping it get passed. So that's basically a great sign and shows their commitment to the effort. So I can pass these out. They're basically stacked one on top of the other. So you take a couple.
So who wrote the language?
Suzanne did.
Okay, she doesn't want to say it, but these are Suzanne's, these are our words, our team's words. I mean, it's the other provisions that were in the earlier versions were like, it's getting in the right direction. It's feeling pretty good. These are the words that we wanted. So... We have a team, right? I mean, but Suzanne was spearheading that.
Yeah, I agree. Obviously it's a team, but I think, from my understanding, this should be called the Early Action Susan Grisel.
Thank you.
Yeah, I mean, this wouldn't have happened without Suzanne. So congratulations.
And it wouldn't have happened without our congressional sponsors and people advancing this. So, I mean, it's very exciting. It took a long time, but it didn't really take that long if you think about it in terms of federal legislation.
We're
happy. And I think what I'm really hoping is that it's something, that a lot of utilities and hydro generators can use to make sure that hydropower stays online and it incents people to invest in their existing infrastructure. And I think that's what our senators and representatives were interested in achieving as well.
You'll notice in here, the one reason we wanted you to have this is because in both press releases, there's quotes from Steve. And then the second part is Senator Cantwell actually used the Rock Island project as the example of why this legislation makes sense. That could come in handy down the road when rules are being made, right, at FERC. And they're saying, well, what was really meant by this? Well, here's a senator on the record basically saying, so... really great. We're going to keep these. This is important. And I do, obviously, Suzanne played a key role in all of this. And we do have a really good D.C. team as well. Mm-hmm. You know, it takes a lot of folks to get pushed a piece of legislation through. And I was talking to Suzanne the last time we were involved with something similar to this, but one that we didn't even spearhead ourselves, but it was back in 2005.
Right.
So it does take some time. And we're not done, right? So now we have a piece of legislation. That legislation needs to turn into actions FERC takes. That needs to turn into Rock Island being in the queue. So we need to know what the process is. We need to get Rock Island in the queue. We need to get on that 60-day notice. So we got some more work to do, but this is a first great step. And anyway, so Suzanne and the rest of the team did a really great job. Questions?
No, just incredible.
Yeah. Great.
Comments, though. Yeah. Good job.
Because it'll be playing out for the next.
Now, I'm trying to express to my wife why I get this text and how exciting they are, or the email, and why they're so excited. She kind of looks at me and goes, "All right, say all that again. You know, tell me why you're that excited." And it is truly meaningful and much appreciated. And again, a great step for our ratepayers. And for hydropower and the state and hydropower in general.
Right.
So nice work. Appreciate your efforts.
All right. Thank you. Good job.
All right.
All right. So we. Yeah. Yep. Oh, I just covered my agenda here. Which commission items? Going once? Gary.
The motions at the 10-1 meeting.
Oh, yeah.
Yep.
I do have a commission item.
Yes. Go ahead, Randy.
As all of you are well aware, I spent a couple of weeks earlier in the country of Kyrgyzstan, and I want to take us all back about 8 years when I went to Kyrgyzstan for the first time with Commissioner Bowles and another orchardist from up the valley, Jim Kempel. And at that moment in time, we were discussing agricultural development, hydro development, and irrigation development. That was the three roles for the three of us. Fast forward to this meeting, and we had a meeting with a group representing an eco cluster. And interestingly, hydro development in that portion of Kyrgyzstan is reemerging as an issue. And it was really a fascinating thing. They'd been looking at all the streams, and as we were there, the streams running into the lake were probably at this moment in time running more than the Wenatchee River, in September. So there's good water flow and good hydro opportunity development. So I just thought that was an interesting aha moment. We haven't talked about it since you were there, and we go back this time, and they've resurfaced that as an issue. Fascinating moment, but it was a great 10 days.
Always, and as I've always commented, of all the people I've had a chance to meet in the world, perhaps the Kyrgyz are the most gentle and just great people to work with.
Marvelous.
So, yeah.
Yes.
Gary.
I just wanted to make a comment on last week's WAPUTA meeting and specifically the telecom committee meeting. Mike Coleman has left already, but I wanted to give Mike kudos and Sean Seaman as well. Both gentlemen have been working tirelessly in order to interface with the governor's task force on broadband as the governor is moving forward with some type of broadband bill that he wishes to bring before the public. And our team has had significant input. That came then in a presentation this last Thursday at the WAPUTA conference, where the entire WAPUTA commissioners had an opportunity to hear what guiding principles might look like in a broadband bill. And with that, we were able to get the unanimous support of all of WAPUTA's commissioners to support a WAPUTA broadband principles bill that would be delivered to the governor's office. So, and the governor's office has voiced significant willingness and desire to work with WAPUTA and all the PUDs on developing a principles-based set of rules for this bill. So, very exciting. All the pieces came together. It appears as though all parties are on the same page, and we're moving forward with a participation with the governor's office. There's going to be a series of phone calls. They'll start off biweekly, probably move down to a weekly basis as we try to keep pace with which the governor's office wants to run, and they will be running to complete this this bill. So very exciting that for oftentimes it doesn't happen that all pieces come together. This happened marvelously. So, as I say, real kudos for Mike Coleman and also Sean Seaman on that.
And do you want these before you go?
Go ahead.
And Gary, that also, I just want to highlight that part of George's goal as the executive director has been to make WAPUTA available as the go-to entity on these kinds of issues. And Governor Inslee's interest in doing that kind of fulfills that goal that George has been working really hard to get to. So much appreciated. Thank you. Other commission items? Okay, we have before us the opportunity for a motion to restructure our October 1st meeting date. It's going to be a heck of a day. We have some things that are timely that need to happen in the morning with the board workshop. And then the afternoon agenda, as you heard, October 1, October 1, October 1, October 1, consistently through our meeting. So it's a start time of 1 for the afternoon, but I'm not saying bring a sleeping bag, but be prepared to be here a while. So with that, I would entertain motions.
Mr. Chairman, I move that we change the board workshop time and location to Monday, October 1st, 2018. From 8 a.m. to 12 p.m. in the Commissioner's Boardroom, and a motion to change the start time for the October 1st, 2018 board meeting to 1 p.m.
Is there a second? Steve? Okay. It's been moved and seconded to change the board workshop time beginning and location to Monday, October 1st, 2018 from 8 a.m. to 12 p.m. in the Commissioner Boardroom and continuing and to change the start time for the October 1st, 2018 board meeting till 1 p.m. Is there discussion? Hearing none, those in favor of the motion as presented signify by saying aye.
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 Motion is carried. Follow up. Delegated items. Delegation of action items.
So there had been three. One was Commissioner McKenna and Arsenault. Wanted to be provided with additional information on cryptocurrency rate options for small miners. I understand that was completed already. Also, Commissioner McKenna was provided, I understand, additional information on how board decisions impact the CIS project.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And then this is going to be something that we'll get back to you on later. It's the staff will present an outreach plan for the fire risk assessment once we know the overall infrastructure investment needed in the Chelan area. Is there anything we missed?
Nothing.
Very good.
All right, thank you. So a delegation of action items for today.
So what I have from today, I'm not sure on this first one, thought that we heard that you'd like Mike to gather information on what service providers are doing to help their low-income customers. Okay, so we'll put that on the list. And then also that we will report on what it costs us to achieve no net impact, and that'll be Ian and Aline who will follow up on that. Anything okay. else?
Can I just say for the record how it warms my heart when you assign those things to Mike? I'm feeling feisty. I just got back from vacation. So.
Well, I suppose you can say that.
Yes, you can. Yeah. Let me put these on so I can see what I'm reading. Additional public comment? Hearing none. Any other matters of general business as may necessarily come before the commission? Hearing none. We need to move into executive session to discuss with legal counsel agency enforcement actions, litigation, potential litigation to which the district or its board is or likely to become a party, and or legal risk as authorized by RCW 42.030.1101I for approximately...
Could we do 30 minutes?
30 minutes.
Hoping to wrap it up quicker than that.
And...
It's music to my ears.
Do you want 5 minutes? Okay, we'll start at 10 minutes to 3.
Thank you.
And hope to be concluded by 3:20.
Okay. Eric? How confusing.
Dennis.
Chelan County Board of Commissioners coming back out of executive session where no decisions were made, no votes were taken. It is 3:22 with no further business to come before the commission. We are adjourned.
Thank you all.
We're 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 adjourned.